Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Okay, let's take a quick look at the things that led up to this extreme violence that happened in Angola. One of the things you need to understand about the wars between blacks and whites in Africa is that the population of the whites, the density of the population of the whites, actually is at its greatest on the southern tip of Africa, in other words, in South Africa. And as you move northwards up to the equator, the population density of the whites drops drastically. And so the further north you go, the less and less whites there are compared to the blacks. And that's a very important point, because when the blacks started fighting against the whites, they started from the north and they moved southwards until eventually South Africa was the only country left fighting. But the vast majority of the whites of Africa lived in South Africa all the time. Now, the original plan to destroy the European empires came from the Jewish communists of the Soviet Union. Round about 1928, that is where this thinking started, to support non-whites in European empires and to try and destroy the empires. At the top of the list was actually the British Empire, believe it or not. And after World War II, the Soviet Union and the Chinese began arming and training blacks in Africa and giving them weapons and funding them so that they could fight the whites. So they taught them the tactics and they gave them the weaponry, and they told them that if you win, you've got to make sure that your country is communist, that you are loyal to us, that sort of thing. And those ties exist even with Russia today. Angola is the size of France and Germany combined, roughly. And to give you an idea of the whites in Africa, up at the equator, there were almost 89,000 whites. But those 89,000 whites were in a country that had 11 million blacks. Then just south of that was Angola with the Portuguese, which had 180,000 whites, 55,000 mixed race, and 4.7 million blacks. Now, the mixed race are because the Portuguese allowed interracial marriages. And about 15% of the Portuguese were involved in these interracial marriages. So that was actually the highest level of miscegenation between the Portuguese and the blacks anywhere in the Portuguese Empire. And as you'll see, the Portuguese thought these things would help them, but it actually didn't. It backfired on them. So, to give you an idea of other whites, if you go further south to Rhodesia, the whites in 1960 were 218,000, but the territory was much smaller. And then if you get to South Africa, you've got 3 million whites in South Africa. And we're looking at the years 1960, 1961. So those were the population ratios. And as you can see, the population, the white population of South Africa is greater than all the whites put together in the rest of Africa. And that's a very important thing to remember. And then later still, whites from the rest of Africa ended up coming to South Africa. So South Africa is now like the final home of all the whites of Africa, the ones who remained. To give you an idea of how outnumbered the Belgians were in the Congo and the Portuguese in Angola, in the Congo, the whites were outnumbered 124-1. In Angola, the Portuguese were outnumbered 26-1. That is even more than the Rhodesians, who were outnumbered 24-1. And you'll see that even when whites are outnumbered 26-1, 24-1, you'd be amazed what whites can still do. You'll be shocked. because that means that whites are less than 5% or 4% of the population. So what really drove the events was that in 1960 in the Congo, the Belgian Congo, which is to the north of Angola, the blacks, especially blacks who were in the military, they rebelled against the Belgians. And all of a sudden, these blacks turned on the whites and they were slaughtering Americans and Europeans and capturing them, etc. And what then happened was the Belgians sent in their paratroopers and they went and evacuated the 89,000 whites or whatever was left of them. And the United Nations also, along with America, evacuated missionaries and whites from the Congo. So the total collapse of the whites in the Congo is what actually kicked off the idea for the mass attack on the whites in Angola. A black guy by the name of Holden Roberto, he was an Angolan and he was in the Congo, and he came up with the idea to train troops, get troops, move into Angola, and then unleash all hell on the whites, just like in the Congo. And he's expecting that when he does this, when they go on an all-out attack against the whites, that they're going to do just like in the Congo. The Portuguese are just going to run for their lives. And the whole idea is to create panic, is to create intense fear, get the whites out, and there you go. Because that's what worked in the Congo. This is Holden Roberto in 1973. So that's the black who planned the most vicious attack ever on whites. He also had a white wife, by the way. And later on, when he needed to get support from other states, he had to get rid of his wife. It seems he had to get rid of his wife and marry a black woman. And only then did he get certain support from other blacks. These blacks also, in the early days, they were very keen to have white wives. There are quite a few of them that had white wives, and this was one of them. But then other blacks are racists. You see, racism is not just a white thing, okay? Other blacks are racist, and they don't like that. And so he got rid of his white wife, and he had to marry a black woman. So when Roberto invaded Angola in March of 1961, he led a small army of between 4,000 and 5,000 guys. They had been trained, they had weapons. I don't know all the weapons they had. Maybe they didn't have automatic weapons. It may be that they mostly had things like hunting rifles and things. But he had an army of 4,000 to 5,000. That was pretty well equipped for normal blacks. And then he grabbed hold of other blacks and forced other blacks to join his forces. And if they didn't, he'd kill them. Now, when he went into northern Angola, his forces took over farms. They overran farms, government outposts, trading centers, and they killed everybody they encountered. Interestingly enough, after his massacres, he went to America to go and speak to John F. Kennedy on the 25th of April, 1961. And it seems that he got some support from America, because when he later went to the president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, and he asked him for support, and Nkrumah turned him down on the grounds that the US government was already paying him. And by the 1970s, his organization was getting military weaponry from America. And also, after he'd committed the massacres of the whites, he went to Israel in the 1960s. And he got aid from the Israeli government from between 1963 to 1969. So this guy got aid as a good guy from America and Israel after he'd gone and done the most brutal massacres against whites, which you'll see photos of later in here. So this guy was not a communist. He was one of the few who wasn't a communist. He wasn't supported by the Soviet Union, wasn't supported by China, but John F. Kennedy and America supported him. Israel supported him. So some shocking stuff there. There were warnings that the Portuguese got before the war, before the massacres. There was an old black corporal who apparently told some Portuguese in November 1960, he told them that the blacks were planning massacres. So months before the attack, the blacks were already busy planning the massacres, but nobody took him seriously. The attacks took place in March 1961. The Portuguese army had stated in 1958 that they believed massacres could happen. And at the time of the attack in Angola, figures differ. Some say that there were as many as 7,800 Portuguese troops in the entire country of Angola. Others say it was 3,000 and maybe even less. But anyway, the bottom line is that there weren't many. There were between 3,000 and 7,000 troops in Angola at the time the massacres took place, but there weren't many in the areas where the massacres took place. As I've said, the Portuguese allowed interracial marriage. Up to 15% of Portuguese were involved in interracial relations. The Portuguese were also different to the Belgians. It had been said that the Belgians were very cruel to the blacks in the Congo. I'm not going to go and discuss that now. That's another topic for another day. So the Portuguese felt very confident that because they are liberal, because they're friendly to the blacks, that the blacks will not turn on them like they did in the Congo. But as you will see in Africa, this doesn't help. Rhodesia, the whites of Rhodesia, where I come from, boasted continuously, "We have the happiest blacks in Africa." And that probably was true. But did it help us in the end? No, it didn't. In apartheid South Africa, the blacks had the highest standard of living in Africa, bar nobody. And how did that work out for the whites of South Africa? Also, didn't work out. In the end, everything becomes racial. Doesn't matter whether you're friendly to them, doesn't matter whether you're liberal, doesn't matter whether you give them money or a higher standard of living. In the end, it becomes racial and it becomes a power struggle, and that's all there is to it. Okay, let's take a quick look at the Battle of Carmona. Here on this map that you see of Africa, you can see Angola. And this was the most important territory in the Portuguese Empire, Angola. On the east coast over here was Mozambique. You had Zambia and Rhodesia in between. But this place was the place that also saw the heaviest, nastiest fighting between blacks and whites that ever took place in the misnamed liberation wars of Southern Africa. These were communist wars that were aimed at putting communists in power in these black countries. And as for liberation and what it would gain the blacks, that was a lot of nonsense that they spoke there. But anyway, be that as it may, the blacks revolted. And the blacks all across Southern Africa, in the end, rebelled against the whites. But the worst, worst fighting of all took place in Angola in the year 1961. This was right at the beginning of the so-called liberation wars. The British had dumped their empire starting in 1960. They just dumped everything in Africa and ran for the hills. And in 1960, also up here in the Congo, the Belgian Congo, the blacks there went absolutely crazy and they were cutting up the Belgians. And the Belgians had to fly in troops to save whites and get whites out. And there were lots of missionaries here as well. Even America was involved a bit in the Congo. Even Britain paid off an army in the Congo. There was a lot of stuff here as they were trying to stop this entire area from totally disintegrating. And there was a lot of fighting in the Congo. But because the fighting had been so rapid in the Congo, one of the black leaders in one of the movements that was fighting for Angola, he came up with the idea that they should try and do the same stuff as in the Congo, also in Angola. And that is what we're going to look at here. And in the next video, I want to just focus on the first year of the war in Angola, because it was the bloodiest, wildest year of all, until the Portuguese could stabilize things. And then the Portuguese started a strategy which would have led to them totally winning in Angola. They were well on their way to victory. They would have kept this place. They would even have held on to Mozambique. And by doing that, they would have saved all of the whites of Southern Africa. Really, this battle here in Angola was so critical. And later, when the Portuguese were out, Rhodesia on a rare occasion even bombed in Angola. South Africa spent much of its time fighting here in Angola. Angola was the absolute heart and soul of the liberation wars. And the loss of Angola and knocking out of the Portuguese brought so much trouble to the rest of the whites of Southern Africa. And South Africa, because of its strength and sophistication, was the only country that could actually operate in Angola and still do things in Angola for many years afterwards. But Angola was the heart and soul. This was the place where the whites came so close to winning. The Portuguese were well on their way to winning. The South Africans were also winning in Angola. And still, we ended up losing this thing. And the loss of Angola was a nasty thing. It started off and set off many negative trends. And the collapse of the Portuguese meant the end of Rhodesia. Once the Portuguese were gone, Rhodesia was just, it was just countdown to our end. It was absolutely disastrous. But I want to look at the real heavy fighting that took place in Angola, because this heavy fighting is so instructive. You can learn so much from this. Now, on this map, you'll see here's part of the border, part of the long border with the Congo. And you see this chunk over here, this little piece here that almost matches, that almost ends in line with this line over here. That area is the area of northern Angola that saw the bloodiest, nastiest black-white conflict you've ever seen. And we want to dig into that because amazing things took place here that nobody on the side of the whites had planned. And it is the actual behavior initially of the normal civilian Portuguese in this area that is astounding. It's stunning. Nothing like this ever happened again. And Carmona is the central core of it, but there was a lot that went on here. So I just want to read to you from Government by Deception. In Government by Deception, my book that I wrote in the year in 2000 to 2001, which I published in 2002, I had a chapter called The White's Last Stand. And we're going to come back to The White's Last Stand because I wrote stuff about South Africa in there. And I think that a lot of stuff that I wrote in my book later became the blueprint for the Suidlanders, including the Suidlanders evacuation plan. There are lots of things in this particular chapter that the Suidlanders seem to have taken and used. And I want to discuss in more detail what I put in The White's Last Stand. And the reason I called it The White's Last Stand was because I look on it as the whites of South Africa, this is the last chance for whites to fight for a chunk of Africa. And if the whites here lose, then whites are out of Africa for an indefinite period of time. Of course, whites can always come back. Europe is very strong. The West is very strong. It's very possible for the West to return to Africa at any point in time. But I think given the long history of the whites in South Africa itself, almost 400 years of history here, it would be very foolish for us to give up this territory. And we've got a lot going for us here in South Africa. As for Angola, the Portuguese had it for 500 years. But the thing was that they mostly stayed on the coast and they didn't go deep inland. A lot of the growth of Southern Africa started as a direct consequence of World War II and the immediate consequences of World War II, when many people left Europe and even Britain to come to Africa. So the population of the whites in Africa got this boost at the end of World War II. But what also came at the end of World War II was Russia and China. So you had the whites growing in strength, seizing the territories, making sure they control everything. The Portuguese were quickly dashing around in Angola and pushing the economic agenda in Angola. And the whites were strengthening themselves everywhere and everything was rocking. And then in comes China and Russia. And they back the blacks, and that unleashes this set of wars known as the Liberation Wars. Basically, a miniature world war among the whites of Africa alone against Russia and China, basically. That's what it basically was. Without America and Britain lifting a finger, literally America and Britain did nothing. Britain definitely did nothing, and the Americans funded a few things with the CIA, but that is as far as it went. Other than that, America and Britain didn't do a damn thing. But the only European country that fought in Africa intensely was Portugal. So Portugal was fantastic, and Rhodesians and South Africans learned tons of stuff from the Portuguese. So my chapter, The White's Last Stand, was about the last fight of the whites in South Africa, an all-out fight, a fight where we look at things like the kind of scenarios that the Sinner van Rensburg people have proposed. That influenced me a lot in my thinking. The Sinner van Rensburg prophecies of these Zuidlanders and others, these things spoke about large-scale conflict in South Africa and the whites being completely annihilated in Johannesburg in particular. All the whites in Johannesburg would die. And so it was those things that prompted me to start really digging into what was going on in these wars and what is possible for us. And when I wrote my book, my chapter, The White's Last Stand, stood out and was weird compared to the rest of the book. People who read my book didn't like, there were many who thought The White's Last Stand is very weird. But now, 20 years later, this chapter may be the most important chapter in the entire book and the most relevant one. Personally, when I wrote this chapter, I must tell you, I had so much fun writing this chapter that I could have written chapters and chapters and chapters based on nothing but the military stuff. I really enjoyed what I was finding and what I was telling people. But there were things, there were clues I left in this chapter that people didn't seem to grasp. And one of the clues had to do with Carmona. So I want to go through a little bit of this just to give you the background, and then we're going to look in detail at what happened in Carmona. On page 256, I wrote the following. In looking for examples of wars that are appropriate to study that could give us ideas about what might work for us. And I write, but a more appropriate example occurred in Angola during its liberation war. In 1961, blacks swept down upon whites all across Angola. And in that case, it was actually more this portion of Angola, the north and the northeast. In 1961, blacks swept down upon whites all across Angola, slaughtering them. On March 15th, hundreds of blacks dragged 42 whites from a small village near the town of Luvo. They stripped them of their clothing and placed the living and the dead on a sawmill and sawed the whites lengthways. A few terrible final screams were heard. Blacks attacked 45 different points along a frontier 500 miles long. Approximately 300 whites and an unknown number of blacks were murdered on March 15th in the northeast corner of Angola. On that day, 37 outposts were wiped clean of whites. So this is the thing that really fascinates me, is that this is the only time that blacks prepared a coordinated campaign to sweep down on the whites, slaughter them like dogs. And the blacks actually expected that if they did this, that the whites would flee. However, what the Portuguese civilians did in Carmona and in some other towns totally turned the tide. It was amazing what they did. So I just want to repeat this piece, because the blacks attacked on a frontier 500 miles long. And they attacked at 45 different points on a frontier 500 miles long. And in one day, they killed 300 whites and an unknown number of blacks. And on that day, there were 37 outposts that were wiped clean of whites. Now, by outposts, I mean small towns and villages, small places, farms. There are various big farms. There are little trading posts and villages. And in 37 of these places, they wiped out the whites. They killed everybody. And the blacks were just rolling forward. And then they got to the town of Carmona. And the little town of Carmona, which had a population of 5,000, though some references I've read speak about 4,000. So we're looking at between 4,000 and 5,000 whites together in a little town. And the blacks have been sweeping down, they're killing everything in their path until they get to Carmona. And they're going to try to do the same thing in Carmona. And that is what we're going to look at. And one of the things that I'd like to urge you with this thing is I'd like you to sit and also think a bit about what you think would happen if you were in a small town and you were told, let me give you some of the story up front so you can just sit and think about it. These whites wake up in the morning, some of them drive to other places. And one of them gets to another little town, and when he gets there, he sees the blacks are busy killing the whites in the streets. And the guy realizes, good God, there's a whole massacre going on. And he races back to Carmona. And they then start getting information. And the information is that, you know, the blacks have gone wild, and the blacks are attacking. So the first thing you got to remember is there's a element of total surprise. The whites are not expecting this at all. And the military aspect of the element of surprise is something that I will be discussing and bringing up again and again. Strictly speaking, in military terms, from actual combat experience, there are people who've studied conflicts and they've come to the conclusion that if any group of people are under attack, that the element of surprise affects you for about 3 days. On the very first day, you are totally, your mind is totally in a state of shock and you are not able to function properly. On the second day, you are in a better frame of mind. And by the third day, you're back to normal. So when you are under extreme shock, it puts you at a big disadvantage. And this will work in the favor of the blacks. And this is a military principle that all armies use all the time. They try to catch their enemy off guard. They try to get what's known as the element of surprise. And in the case of the whites in northern Angola, they are completely shocked and utterly astounded by what happens. And they're in a state of shock. So they're not at their best. However, despite being caught totally off guard by the enemy, they still manage to pull off an amazing feat at Carmona. So these whites, during the day then, once they realize that there's something hideously wrong, and they start communicating and phoning other people, because in those days there were only landlines, and I think they also might have had radio communications. So what happens is that these whites in that day in Carmona realize that 30,000 blacks are coming to attack Carmona later, possibly in the evening. So early in the morning, they discover this and they realize the blacks are coming and there's 30,000 of them, but there are only 4,000 or 5,000 whites in Carmona. What are they going to do? They communicate with the Portuguese government, they communicate with Luanda, the capital, and they say they need troops immediately. And there is a landing strip nearby. But because of tremendously heavy cloud cover, they are told that no ways in hell is a plane going to be able to fly there and land there on that day. That they've got to wait for the cloud cover to clear. Nowadays, we wouldn't have those problems with some of the advanced instrumentation on aircraft, but back then it was a problem. So these Portuguese civilians find themselves in a situation where they want to call in the army to come and help, and now the army can't be there. And they are told, you've got to wait the next 24 hours. We can only send the troops tomorrow when the cloud cover eases off. So you've got to defend yourselves today. Nobody can come and help you. Nobody. And then these people start making a plan. In the town, there were only 19 soldiers and one machine gun. So you've got 19 soldiers. Many of them are black soldiers. You've got a white guy. He's got the machine gun, and that's what you got. And you got the civilians. The civilians have got handguns, hunting rifles, shotguns, and now they realize that nobody can help them. All they've got is whatever they've got on hand, and in less than 24 hours, 30,000 blacks are coming at them. Now, Holden Roberto is the black guy of a group called the UPA, who conceived of this plan. And Roberto managed to get 5,000 troops armed and trained here in the Congo. And he comes from a tribe that is here in the northern part of Angola. So he came in with his trained army of 5,000. And then he also picked up other blacks and forced other blacks even. They came either willingly or unwillingly, and they came and joined him. Blacks who did not join him were killed. And so as they're sweeping down over the whites here, they are also killing any blacks that are still loyal to the whites. They're slaughtering blacks as well. But their goal is actually to kill the whites. The whites are the real problem. So he's got 5,000 troops, and then he gathers others with him. Now, what we don't know about Carmona is how many of those troops, of his 5,000, were involved in the attack on Carmona. We don't know. So that is something that's a bit of an unknown. So there are blacks with weapons and others also just with machetes. So they're also a hodgepodge, but there is some element of them that's armed, but we don't know how much. So all these whites know is that maybe tonight 30,000 blacks are going to attack us. And these people in Carmona start making plans. They've just got hours to go. What are they going to do? How are they going to survive this unbelievable attack that's going to hit them? And that's what we're going to study today. We're going to look at the amazing Battle of Carmona and what the whites did there. So let's take a look at an animation. Here is a animated map that shows the attacks into Angola. And this will give you an idea as the blacks came in down various places and how they branched out and they went and attacked certain places. And you'll see some of the towns mentioned here. And you'll see, I think those red areas might be the outposts or things that they're attacking, farms or whatever. And that there you can see all the different places and targets that they're sort of going for. And then there are little towns. And now over here you can see Carmona. There's Carmona. And they are sweeping everything clean. Sort of. I'll explain more in the next video. But the main place where they run into a problem is the town of Carmona. It's got the biggest population, between 4,000 to 5,000, and here is a huge battle that takes place. So you can see how the blacks have come in from all sorts of areas. And there are other uprisings as well that are starting from other sides. In fact, Carmona becomes the center of many battles for months, actually. But it's the first battle that is the one that we're going to be looking at in detail. Because white civilians are by themselves and they have to make a plan. What can they do? So if you look on this map, you can see on this map the same area. There you can see the northern part. And here you can see there's Luvo, the sawmill, where they sawed the whites in half. You can see other little areas. And then you can see Carmona. Ngage is another important one. And Quitex is another one that we're going to look at. We're going to look at that today because in Quitex, the blacks kill all the whites here in this little place. So the blacks are sweeping down all round and others are rising up from other places. But it's here in Carmona that the big fight takes place. And the whites pull off an amazing thing. So just to read to you from Wikipedia what it says there about this time. It says, on 15th March 1961, the Union of Peoples of Angola, UPA, under the leadership of Holden Roberto, launched an incursion into northern Angola from its base in the Congo, Leopoldville, ex-Belgian Congo, leading 4,000 to 5,000 militants. So that's his main core trained army. His forces took farms, government outposts, and trading centers, killing and mutilating officials and civilians, most of them of Mbundu contract workers from the Central Highlands. It was the start of the Angolan War of Independence and of the wider Portuguese Overseas War. UPA militants stormed the Angolan districts of Zaire, Uige, Kuanza Norte, and Luanda. They even fought a bit in Luanda, which is the capital, massacring the civilian population during their advance, killing 1,000 whites and 6,000 blacks. Women and children are included. Women and children included of both white European and black African descent. So they killed everybody, men, women, and children. And the total given here for the whites is 1,000. Other estimates are 700 or 800. So it's anything from between 700 to 1,000 whites. And then the blacks are 6,000. That they kill. So any blacks that are still friendly to the whites get killed. This is the basic nature of all the warfare in southern Africa. Any blacks who are friendly to the whites are seen as traitors and they are killed. And they are killed or tortured or whatever. And That, I'm afraid, is the reality, because it's actually a wise thing that the blacks are doing, because they are getting rid of their traitors. And we whites have got our traitors that we need to get rid of, who stand in our way. So it continues, besides the killing of people, the UPA militants destroyed the infrastructures they found on their way, including houses, farms, roads and bridges, creating a general chaos and panic. The terrified populations took refuge in the forests or fled to nearby regions and to Congo, Leopoldville. So some blacks even fled out of Angola into the Congo, where the UPA actually comes from. So the blacks are also fleeing. But here's the kicker. However, and contrary to the expectations of the UPA, the majority of the white inhabitants that were able to survive the initial attacks did not flee, except some women and children that were evacuated to Luanda. So the majority of the Portuguese who survived, the men stayed and they fought on here. And that is the amazing thing that we're going to start looking at. This fight by civilian Portuguese men, what they did against these blacks. Okay, let's get on with it. This is from the book, The Fabric of Terror, written in 1965. So this contains some first-hand accounts of the events of that time. So you saw on that previous map, Quetex is a small place to the south of Carmona. So let's start with that, and then we'll head into the Battle of Carmona. You'll see how these are linked together. So the massacre at Quetex. Quetex is a village and small commercial center located about 40 kilometers south of Carmona, the capital of the coffee-rich Uige district of northern Angola. On the morning of March 15, 1961, Quetex was one of the targets of bands of terrorists who were disguised as early shoppers. The massacre, which began as the village church bells tolled 8 o'clock. The Portuguese have got these church bells that they ring in these villages, and they are useful also for calling people together and for warning people. So it says, the massacre, which began as the village church bells tolled 8 o'clock, was one of the fastest and most horribly efficient of all the terrorist onslaughts which occurred that day all over northern Angola. So blacks were disguised as early shoppers and they went to work on the whites among them. The village butcher, his wife and his daughter escaped the slaughter. Their escape was a narrow one. Instinct on the part of the man must have been what saved them. Both the butcher and his pretty daughter were semi-professional hunters, and they kept an assortment of rifles and ammunition in their second-floor apartment above the shop, where they sold meat and hides. A year later, I visited the man in his house at Quetex, and he described to me the terrifying events of that unforgettable morning. On the commode in the modest dining room rested an amateurish photograph of a pretty brunette with curly hair. I have sent my girl to the south. I don't want her around here with all these soldiers. They are nice boys, but you understand what I mean, he said apologetically. Yeah, nature will do its work, okay? From these two windows in this room, I can see most of the houses in the village, the butcher began, pointing to specific places as he spoke. I can see the doors of the two grocery stores, the clothing store, the pharmacy, the hardware and farming store, the gas and oil station, the trading post, the post office. We open our doors for business at 8 o'clock sharp, but I get up at 6 every morning to feed the animals, cut the meat, and sort out the fish. I always eat a heavy breakfast at 7:30. At least a bowl of soup, eggs and sausage, bread and coffee. I always eat well in the morning. But that morning, when my wife Maria, my daughter Lourdes, and I sit down at the table for breakfast, I cannot even eat my soup. My stomach feels funny, nervous. I say to myself, I am not sick. Why do I not eat? My wife turns to me and says, why do you not eat, man? Are you sick? I am not sick, but something is wrong. My daughter Lourdes says, it is so quiet outside. And that is indeed funny, because at 7:30 the natives and farmers who come up from the Sanzalas and farms to do their shopping or trade are usually talking loud and laughing in groups while waiting for the stores to open. So you see, he senses a difference in the behavior of the blacks. So there's a trigger. I go to the window to see. There they are, as usual, the natives and a few white farmers in front of the doors of the stores. But the funny thing is that the natives are not talking loud or joking or laughing. They are kind of huddled in groups, looking sullen or talking low. See, he's noticing differences in behavior. Even funnier, most of them are wearing their heavy coats, although the morning is warm. He's noticing things are out of place, behavior has changed. Very, very astute. These are important things. This is all part of life and warfare. My daughter turns to me and says, do you think, Papa, that they are hiding something under their coats? It is now less than 7:45. There is a group of 8 natives in front of my door. So I stick my head outside the window and greet them. Good morning, boys. And 3 of them raise their heads and greet me back. Good morning, boss. Let me just pause there. We in Africa refer to the blacks as boys. And I don't know where the word comes from, why we use the term boys, because it sounds like they're immature. And in reality, they are immature and they are silly and stupid. And that is how we called all blacks. We called them boy. And maybe it's a way of looking down on them because we regard them as idiots, as like children, you know. Good morning, boss. But the other 5 are like statues. I do not see their faces. I do not know who they are, but I feel something is wrong. We have no telephone from house to house here, so I cannot warn the others. Papa, shall I go and warn the other stores that something may be wrong? My daughter asks, and I whisper back to her, are you crazy, girl? Bring the rifles and ammunition quickly. As I told you, sir, both Lords and myself are good hunters. Now it is only a few minutes before 8 o'clock. I am not going to open my door. Let me pause there. This man is extremely astute in his sense of feeling and reading the blacks and greeting them to see if they are different. He's definitely very awake. And these are the kinds of skills that you develop with time. With time, even in conflict, you start to see things and notice things, and your sense of people will become more astute. You will trust people less, and you'll watch things, and you'll notice things. And in this case, the blacks are busy with a deception, and the man is noticing something is weird. Lourdes and I are kneeling with our loaded rifles by the window. So clearly he and his daughter they distrust the blacks. So that's good. That's what's going to save them. While my wife stands behind us to hold a third rifle and reload ours, I feel now that something terrible is about to happen, and I am ready. The church tower strikes 8 o'clock, and the doors of the stores start to open, and all the natives and the few white farmers walk in. My head is still outside the window, but I do not show my rifle. One of the natives below raises his head, grins at me and says, "Open the door, boss." And I grin back and tell him, "In a minute, boy, in a minute." Very clever. Obviously, this man has a wider understanding. He's more awake. Maybe he knew more about the Belgian Congo and distrusted the blacks. Other Portuguese did not, but let's carry on. It is only a few minutes after 8 o'clock, and all of a sudden, it is like a hurricane in hell. The most awful screams from everywhere in the village. Horrible screams, mostly from women and children. I figure that the terrorists started the slaughter inside the stores and in the other houses exactly at the same time. The screams are so piercing that for a moment Lourdes and my fingers are frozen on the triggers. You see, these blacks have been planning this. These things are planned. And even the attacks, the massacres all across the north were planned the previous year already. So they've been planning it, okay? These blacks have planned a strategy and they're executing it now. The natives under my window draw their machetes and scatter guns from under their coats and start yelling, "Mata, Upa, Mata, Upa," that's UPA, and begin chopping at my door. I say to Lourdes, "Keep cool, girl, and don't miss a shot." In 30 seconds, we blow the heads off the 8 terrorists under my window. The 3 of them I know from around here look up at me, kind of surprised and indignant as I shoot at them. They feel I have got no right to shoot them, but they have got the right to murder me and my wife and rape my daughter. It is a funny world. The screams become moans, fewer and fewer, because the dead do not complain anymore. A few of the victims, blood all over them, manage to run onto the street. So some drawings in this book. But the bandits go after them, yelling like crazy, and finish them off, cutting off their arms or legs or heads. It is horrible to see this from my window. Lourdes and I are finished with the 8 bandits under my window. So now we shoot at the ones chasing our people on the street. My old friend Carvalho, the farmer from Aldeia, Vicosa, runs out of the hardware store. He is bleeding. He has no weapon, and 2 terrorists close in on him for the kill. I aim my rifle and shoot, but I miss the 2 bandits and hit my old friend, who drops dead. I cry, "God forgive me." But Lourdes quickly kills both terrorists with her repeating rifle. By the way, women can be excellent shots. Excellent. Women can be freaking good snipers even. The white women can rock when they are taught how to shoot. They can sometimes shoot better than the men. Then I see this child, the little daughter of the clothing store, running into the street with a big black after her. My wife cries, "Oh Lord, have mercy." And then I see the Land Rover of Dr. Souza from Carmona wheeling down the road and almost hitting the child. Let me pause there. Dr. Souza is going to become the main character in Carmona. He's just driven in and he sees this stuff. Dr. Souza is going to save Carmona. And then I see the Land Rover of Dr. Souza from Carmona wheeling down the road and almost hitting the child. The doctor steps on the brakes when he sees the child, but the terrorist pays no attention to the doctor and splits open the head of the child with his machete. My wife begins to scream and my daughter is sobbing, but still holding onto her rifle. The doctor gets his automatic from the glove compartment and shoots the bandit. So you see, these Portuguese, they're pretty well armed, some of them. So the doctor pulls out his pistol and blows the bandit away. Crazily, the doctor jumps out of the Land Rover to go toward a group of yelling terrorists coming out of the pharmacy. I yell at him, "Doctor, get the hell out of here," and give the warning at Carmona. The doctor comes to his senses, jumps back into the Land Rover, turns round and drives away fast before the terrorists can get him. We have lots of ammunition, thank God, so Lourdes and I keep on firing. We kill a few more, and the others disappear behind the houses. Now everything is very quiet. I do not hear even a moan. Though one of the bad things, let me pause here, one of the things is he's got no communications. So Dr. Souza knows about him, but I don't think the guy has a telephone. So let's see what happens. Now everything is very quiet. I do not hear even a moan. There are only pieces of human bodies on the street and doorways of the stores, and pools of blood are everywhere. My wife and Lourdes are sobbing, and I give them big glasses of brandy to steady them. I fear the terrorists are about to storm my house, so we load our guns and prepare to make them pay heavily. I swear I'll kill my wife and my daughter before the beasts get their hands on them. But everything stays very quiet. I wait. Maria and Lourdes are now saying the rosary and weeping while I keep my watch by the window. 9 o'clock comes and the church bell does not toll. The big birds are flying overhead and I shoot at them to scatter them away. I wait. The terrorists do not come back to my house. Around noon, a platoon of soldiers arrives from Carmona. It is much too late for the dead. These soldiers are the only soldiers in the area. So, that was the massacre at Quetex, and that is how that man survived, he and his family, thanks to their hunting skills. He and his daughter actually make the terrorists pay a heavy price. So, they've actually killed a bunch of terrorists. Between them and Dr. Souza, they've killed a bunch of blacks, even though they were completely taken by surprise. Totally. It's incredible luck, but maybe also some skill there from just all that hunting practice. And being able to read the blacks and read animals and stuff like that. So now let's get into the Battle of Carmona. So here we have the town of 4,000 to 5,000 whites. And there's a poem here. O evil night, for whom lie you in wait? For the poor soldiers and the shepherds of flocks and the men of the sea. What will you grant them? So, the Battle of Carmona. Carmona, the capital of the Uige district in northern Angola, is a modern and well-planned town which can be found in the American Southwest or in southern Europe. It is 40-odd kilometers north of Quetex and rests comfortably on a small and fertile plateau, surrounded by the greenery of a pleasant valley and the rolling hills beyond. Let me pause there. Angola is very beautiful, and it's got lots of vegetation and trees and cover, which also makes it a difficult place to fight. So it's a very beautiful place Think of something like Vietnam as being almost similar. It was practically born with the coffee boom in northern Angola, and it nearly faced extinction on that fateful day of March 15th, 1961. It was nearly 10 o'clock in the morning of that day when a dozen customers, enjoying their morning coffee on the veranda of the Grand Hotel du Huig, were rudely shaken by the stormy arrival of a careening Land Rover which shot into town from the Quetex Road. So it's now 10 o'clock here. The massacre started at 8 o'clock in Quetex. And here is Dr. Souza arriving. The driver was Dr. Souza, a civic leader of Carmona, a normally calm person, 60 years of age, with a leathery face, disorderly gray hair, and penetrating brown eyes. He slammed on the brakes as he approached the Grand Hotel and shouted at the sleepy group on the veranda, "To your guns and lock your doors. Terrorism has broken out. I'm going to the governor." Before those on the veranda had a chance to digest the warning, Dr. Souza was off to the sidewalk cafe further up the main avenue. "To your guns, terrorists are coming," he shouted at the perplexed patrons at the sidewalk tables. He did not stop again until he reached the governor's mansion at the end of the avenue. "Is the doctor out of his mind?" asked one man. "I have no gun. What is he talking about?" asked a second. "He said terrorists." "Where? What terrorists?" exclaimed a third. "We may as well find out what is going on," said the first one, and the group from the sidewalk cafe began to walk in the direction of the governor's mansion. At the same time, most of the customers from the veranda of the Grand Hotel began to head slowly in the same direction. When the two groups merged at the gates of the mansion, they were joined by others, mostly men and boys. But the two stern Sipayo sentries, native soldiers of the regular infantry company stationed at Carmona, barred the entrance with crossed bayonets. "What is going on?" asked a bystander. "Dr. Souza said something about terrorism. Maybe it was a fight between the Bakongos and the Bailundos." He's referring to different tribes. Blacks fight among each other. "They hate each other's guts," ventured one of the cafe customers. "Who knows? Maybe the United Nations has invaded Angola," another bystander speculated, half seriously. Some of the spectators laughed, but others made grimaces. No one seemed particularly alarmed. The crowd lingered about the gate, attracting newcomers, and some of them speculated wildly on the reasons for the doctor's panic. Presently, a military jeep, traveling even faster than Dr. Souza's Land Rover, rounded the big post office building, shot through the crowd, and came to a stop at the gate. "What is going on, Captain?" several voices shouted. "I don't know," the officer replied as he dashed through the gate. Hardly a minute elapsed before the governor's secretary, a pleasant young man with a boyish face, emerged and climbed to the front seat of the jeep. Someone grabbed his sleeve. "What on earth is going on?" he asked. "Let go of my sleeve, man. Terrorism has broken out in the country, but keep calm. A few of you run to the churches and ask the priests to toll the alarm. On to the barracks, driver." So let me just pause here. So the whites are moving fast. They are not mucking around. Dr. Souza is moving at the fastest possible speed. Time is of the essence. Because you don't know what's coming next, you see. Let's continue. Half the crowd dispersed quickly, some going to the churches, others hurrying home to their families. Minutes later, a motorcyclist arrived at great speed. "Do you know anything, senor? asked an anxious bystander. "Yes," the motorcyclist answered as he removed his goggles. An amateur radio operator near Nova Kaipemba has been flashing a message, and I just caught it on my shortwave set. "There has been a massacre at Nova Kaipemba this morning. I must see the governor at once, Corporal." Let me pause here. What you are now seeing is the result of this mass attack that's taken place. The whites don't know it's a mass attack. They don't know that it's occurring on a massive front. But now communications is starting to kick in. And communications is allowing the whites to start communicating a little bit with each other. And now this information is coming through. And of course, this is spreading in other places as well. So here is one of the first critical points of any major attack, is that the attack can be secret, it can be executed nicely, but the clock is ticking. And sooner or later, somebody uncovers something and they can run somewhere or notify someone. And so this is how the element of surprise is slowly being frittered away. And the attackers had total surprise in Quitex. But by the time they get to Carmona, these people have already started getting some information. So this is also why speed and also hitting lots of places at exactly the same time is critical. There has to be a very well-planned operation. Otherwise, the moment that you slow down and the message manages to spread while you're slowing down, the others can start building up defenses and preparing actions. This is a military problem that these blacks face. But let's give them credit. They have managed to wipe out lots and lots of places on that morning quickly. But now, as the clock is ticking, the information is moving, and so people are starting to pick up the pieces and starting to realize something's on the go. And this is the defensive side of an attack on you. And in the case of whites in South Africa, which is the topic that we're really interested in, this is what would happen. The enemy would do things, but the message is going to start spreading. And that message can cause people to start taking more and more defensive actions. And for the attacker has got a real problem in terms of time. The slower he is, the more time the message has got to spread, and the more preparation the whites can engage in. And that is what you need to think about in the sort of offensive-defensive situation. If you're an attacker, you want to move fast. You don't want to give your enemy any chance to prepare. If you're a defender, then you want to slow down the attacker and you want to have time to prepare and time to spread the message. So here you can see that because Carmona is quite a distance away from the borders, they are now also starting to get information moving in. And this, even though this is just a few hours ahead of the coming attack, it's a few valuable critical hours that will allow them to save many of their lives, most of their lives. So let's see. "There's been a massacre at Nova Kaipemba this morning. I must see the governor at once, Corporal." "I will take you in," the corporal of the guard said, opening the gate. Suddenly the crowd began to realize that something frightening was happening around them. Faces became tense and eyes somber. But Dr. Souza was not coming from Nova Kaipemba. "He arrived from the Quitex Road," said a boy in the crowd. "Maybe the doctor saw something toward Quitex," said another boy. "How far is Nova Kaipemba from here?" someone asked. A About 100 kilometers, another one answered. Well, that gives us a little time. They're probably walking through the bush. What guarantee do you have that it will be the same ones? So the whites are piecing together the bits that they know. Dr. Souza emerged from the governor's mansion, a worried look on his face. Is it bad, doctor? A woman asked. I'm afraid it may be very bad, the doctor answered. Then he raised his voice to reach everyone in the crowd. Now you people, I suggest that you leave your women and children locked up at home. Get whatever weapons you have and join me in the gymnasium as soon as possible. We have to organize some kind of civilian brigade, and quickly, because there are so few soldiers here. The ones living on the edge of town had better bring their women and children to the gymnasium and the radio station. Pass the word. So already they are starting to bring the women and children to the safest place, and they're going to put them in the safe place, and then the others are going to... So these whites, with just hours on their hands, they have to immediately, with immediate effect, form a military unit. They aren't a military unit. They have not prepared as a military unit, but all they've got is whatever weapons they have at hand. And they have to form a military unit immediately because an attack is coming. So this will give you an idea of the speed with which people have to move and the speed with which whites can move. As the doctor headed for his Land Rover, the churches of Carmona began to toll the alarm and the spines of the people began to shiver. Dr. Souza drove now at a moderate pace along the well-paved streets of Carmona, past the cement buildings with their balconies, fragrant with vases of sweet basil and violets. He saw the curious and frightened faces of women as they began to understand the meaning of the church bells. Presently, the doctor stopped his car in front of the last house on a dead-end street in the eastern part of the town. The house was a comfortable two-story building of masonry, a mixture of 19th-century colonial and provincial Portuguese, which included a wide stone stairway from the ground to the veranda on the second floor, and a well-tended garden on the side of the house. The road east to Ngage could be seen from the windows. His son, a dark young man of 30, wearing a physician's white coat, was standing at the door. Let me just pause here and tell you that his son is going to die today. His son will be one of the people who will die today. Why are the bells ringing so insistently? A big fire? The younger Souza asked. Do you still have any patients in the office? His father asked. No, I just got rid of the last one. The servants? They're gone after the bells, I believe. All right, Pedro. Take off your white coat, get your rifle and ammunition. Bring your own car and join me at the gymnasium. What goes on, father? You were gone to Quitex this morning. I was, son, and as I entered the village, the terrorists began slaughtering everybody in sight, including the children. I barely had time to turn around and drive back here to give the alarm. I'm going to collect my own rifle and automatic. Without a word, Dr. Pedro followed his father into the house. 15 minutes later, the senior doctor joined his son and a few other men at the door of the radio station, which was located across the street from the Grand Hotel. The hotel veranda was now empty, as were the sidewalk tables of the cafe. Several civilians carrying weapons were walking rapidly towards the gymnasium. You go into the station, Pedro, Dr. Souza told his son, and tell the girl announcer to give periodic warnings. Ask people to lock doors and windows and be on the alert. Then the doctor drove his Land Rover up the main avenue past the governor's mansion and came to a stop in front of the large CTT, Post, Telegraph and Telephone building. Inside, a few people appeared to be glued to the main counter, their anxious eyes on the two employees who seemed either inscrutable or ignorant of what was going on. Dr. Souza walked directly into the office of the postmaster, a middle-aged man with completely white hair. "Well," the doctor asked, "the telephone and the telegraph lines have been cut," the postmaster announced somberly. "So the landlines have been cut, but there is radio." So how important is radio, eh? "We finally got Luanda on the wireless. Very bad connection, but here it is. Our airstrip is completely closed by ground fog, which is covering the entire plateau. Luanda cannot land any reinforcements here today, even if they had them, so they don't have them. In all of Angola, they only had 7,800 troops on that day, and Angola is much larger than France, so there were hardly any troops. Nobody expected this. They say they will try tomorrow, if we are still here." So, not fun kind of response that you'd like to hear. "They'll come tomorrow if we're still alive." "We asked them to drop paratroopers on the Ngage Valley, where the fog is not so bad. They say they have no paratroopers. They are going to ask Lisbon for some, but this will take a couple of days at best. In other words, today the only thing we can get from Luanda is their sympathy." How miserable, hey? So here you are, the blacks are going to attack, people have been killed, and there's nobody to help you. You're fucking on your own. But you'll see what these Portuguese do. "So that is it," Dr. Souza claims, shaking his head. "That is it, I'm afraid," the postmaster concurred. "Any new reports?" the doctor asked. "A report of other attacks at Nambuangongo and Buela, but no details." The postmaster said, "Was it bad at Quitex, doctor?" "Sickening. They must have attacked as the stores opened at 8 o'clock. When I arrived in the village, they were dragging the bodies onto the little square and cutting them to pieces with their machetes. It will be a miracle if anybody at Quitex escaped that massacre." "Oh God," cried the postmaster and crossed himself. The Christian cross. It was noon when the doctor walked into the gymnasium, which was filled with several hundred men and teenage boys, armed with an assortment of weapons. From modern repeating rifles and automatic pistols to ancient hunting rifles, machetes, and even swords and native spears with bayonets. So they're just picking up anything they can get because not all of them have got weapons. Some of the enterprising teenagers had tied native katanas with wire to the tips of wooden poles, making a kind of a lance. So here are some of the young teenage Portuguese already busy improvising. They've not been in war or battle before, but they're already thinking up stuff in the heat of the moment. It's dodgy stuff, but they're doing something. They're trying things. This is what you do when your life is on the line. Then you start making plans real quick. And that is something for all whites to remember. When you're in deep, deep trouble, let me tell you, people who you thought wouldn't do things will start doing things. When your life is truly under threat, you'll see how people will react. You're then going to have a desire to live. But these youngsters are making plans. They're not freaking out, eh? Outside the gymnasium, 200 or 300 more people, similarly armed, lingered about amid an array of vehicles, which ranged from open lorries to jeeps and small sports cars. Perhaps half the crowd had firearms. The improvised weapons of the other half would be only as effective as the recklessness of their bearers. So, only half of the crowd have any kind of firearms. Any kind, which means even pistols, you know, which is not exactly the kind of thing you'd want to be using in a war. You'd like something better, but anyway. They're making do. The blacks themselves are also armed in a hodgepodge way, apart from some who are properly armed. So you've got two sides that are not well armed, but they're going to fight it out anyway. And the blacks are going to attack because the blacks are sure they can take these whites. They're sure they can kill them, and they're determined. Dr. Souza elbowed his way to the stage where a colono was haranguing the crowd. The doctor became aware that the mood of his fellow colonos was an angry one. It was directed against the Governor General in Luanda and the government in Lisbon for having neglected the defense of northern Angola against the possibility of just such a terrorist onslaught, particularly in the light of what had been happening next door, in the next country, in the Congo. There were scattered shouts of death and down to the rulers they considered responsible for their predicament. Let me just mention again that the Portuguese army in 1958 had warned that there could be a problem in Angola. But because the Portuguese were so confident that their relations with the blacks were good, they didn't expect that anything like what happened in the Congo could happen in Angola. It's a rerun of Rhodesia, you know. We have got the happiest blacks of Africa. The whites of South Africa having all these blacks whom they have treated so well for so long. Are they going to turn on you? Yes, the fuck they are. They are going to turn on you. When it comes to power and they start believing they can win, they do turn on you. So here are the Portuguese, multiracial, some have even married into the blacks, and now they're realizing, good God, it's happening. The blacks are at our door, and we're defenseless. We begged time and again for modern weapons to keep in our homes as a kind of militia. And what happened? Luanda and Lisbon ignored us. We begged time and again for a strong military garrison. And what happened? So they have enough knowledge of the blacks to know that the blacks are dangerous. So they have asked for weapons from the government in the past, but the government hasn't given them any. Most likely the government didn't think it was necessary. There was nothing that suggested to them that there would come a time where the blacks would launch a massive assault. So everything is totally unexpected. The whites are caught totally off guard. They've not even had much time to think about things. Dr. Souza pushed the orator away from the microphone. All this is true, and I should know it better than anybody else, the doctor began, as the shouts from the audience quietened down. But I did not ask you to come here for a debate. We may have little time left, and we must brace ourselves for our own defense. There are 5,000 of us in Carmona, and only a company of soldiers. So here he's saying there are 5,000 of us in Carmona, and only a company of soldiers. And most of those soldiers are black, by the way. No more, doctor, no more, the previous speaker interrupted loudly, waving his arms. The captain and the first platoon are now driving north to Nova Kaipemba, and a lieutenant and a second platoon have been dispatched south towards Quitex, Only the sentries at the governor's mansion are left. Now the soldiers have been sent elsewhere, and now it's just civilians and a handful of black sentries. Dr. Souza was speechless for a few seconds. "It is not possible," he finally exclaimed. "I saw the lorries and jeeps with my own eyes," protested the other man. Several shouts from the audience confirmed the report. With great difficulty, the doctor restored order in the noisy audience. "No matter. We must remain calm and brace ourselves for the attack," the doctor began, as the crowd again deferred to him. So let me pause there. The doctor is acting as a good leader. He's guiding the people and he's saying to them, "Listen, no time for talk. We got to get ready. These people are coming to kill us. You know, no time for debating now." "I am not a general, but I suggest a plan as follows. The best marksmen with rifles take positions in the upstairs windows of the stronger houses along the edges of town. All women, except the ones who have rifles and are good shots, and children should be kept here in the gymnasium and in the warehouse." So the women who are good shots and armed, they must also help. "All the other men and boys form motorized patrols. Open lorries and Land Rovers are the best cars, I think. Fill all the tanks with gasoline. When they come, do not wait for them. Go toward them and kill them as fast as you can. Remember, they will not spare you or your women or your children. When the attack starts, all the church bells must toll as loudly as possible. The noise may confuse some of us, but it will confuse them even more, I am sure. When they set fire to a house, do not waste your time trying to stop the fire. Your business is to kill terrorists, not save the property." And by the way, these Portuguese are referring to these blacks as terrorists all the time, and that is what they are. They are using terror. But funny, no Jews and no Americans and no United Nations concern over this. And just a note that Holden Roberto, the leader of the UPA, who organized this brutal assault on these Portuguese, he actually later goes to Israel and the Israelis give him money and support. I'm not sure exactly what support they gave him, but Israel did give this guy support after he had slaughtered these whites. You can read up about it. So he says, "If they set fire to a house, do not waste your time trying to stop the fire. Your business is to kill terrorists, not to save property. When this is over, it is better to have a burned town and people still living than a preserved house with nothing but our dead bodies in it." So let me just pause there. Here he is quickly thinking up a strategy in the heat of the moment. And one of the strangest things that he comes up with is this idea of motorized patrols. And the motorized patrols are going to go and fight the blacks hand to hand, literally. So that for me is something unbelievable. I can't even believe that you would think like that. But this is a very bold plan, and they do actually do this. I can tell you that no other whites in Southern Africa have ever sat back and had to think of fighting blacks hand to hand. But here are the Portuguese, and they're going to do it. Some of them are going to die in the process. But this is very fascinating. So those who've got firearms are going to be shooting, and they're going to be shooting from the upper stories of the buildings. But the others are actually going to go straight at the blacks and attack them straight on. So no defensive positions here. They're going to attack. And it's something to sit and ponder. It's a very interesting concept. So let's carry on. The drums, someone shouted at the door of the gymnasium. The grim crowd began to evacuate the gymnasium in orderly fashion. It was 1 o'clock in the afternoon and the clouds were still hanging low over Carmona. Dr. Pedro joined his father in the Land Rover. The monotonous call of the drums, there must have been hundreds of them, came from the hills north and west of Carmona, from the tall elephant grass in the valley east of the town, and from the forest to the south along the Quitex Road. And it reached their ears like the sinister overture of a Wagnerian opera. About to be staged in the heart of Africa. The church bells of Carmona were now silent, but the roar of automobile and lorry engines filled the street. Dr. Souza headed the Land Rover up the street in the direction of the military barracks, and he turned on the radio. Let me just mention, here in Africa, yes, the blacks do use drums. Even here in the city, there are places where blacks have gathered and they do church stuff, and I've heard drums, even here in Johannesburg. It's not common, but where I am, I have on occasion sometimes heard it. But yes, in Africa, in the rural areas, the drums are used. So the blacks are using the drums like the whites are using the church bells. They're using them as a means of communication. So there's something afoot. All these hundreds of drums being banged, the blacks are sending a message to other blacks, but the whites are hearing it. So the blacks are giving away a bit of a thing here. This is maybe an error on the part of the blacks. The blacks should maybe have kept quiet, unless there was purpose to the drums. Maybe the drums are calling on other blacks to come together. So maybe that is the real purpose. In which case, it's also sending a message to the whites who are awake. Any chance that we may be heard anywhere? Dr. Pedro asked as he quietly polished his rifle with a suede cloth. Not a chance, son. The radius of our transmitter is 20 or 30 kilometers, if that much. And we do not have a shortwave transmitter, the older D'Souza said. But we will be heard by the fellows beating the drums around Carmona. Many of them have transistor radios. So let me pause here. The whites now hatch a new plan. Some psychological warfare. Blacks in Africa, even when I was a kid, they used to love radios. And they'd listen to music and the news. And so here the Portuguese now think up a plan. Some psychological warfare coming from the whites to the blacks. Quick thinking. The sweet, delicately feminine voice of the disc jockey was coming through like a timid solo against the menacing background of the still distant drums. I shall repeat this warning and other flashes at periodic intervals, she was confiding to the microphone. Next you will hear the inimitable voice of your and my favorite, the great Amalia, Queen of the Fado. But then she suddenly interrupted herself. The station has just learned that practically the entire company of soldiers stationed at Carmona has been sent. Christ Almighty, swore the doctor as he slammed on the brakes and turned off the radio. That girl is telling the enemy that we are even weaker than they think. So he's thinking fast, okay? And he's realizing, don't get your enemy's confidence up. In this case, don't let them know that all the fucking soldiers have left the town. So he says, Pedro, you run back to the station and tell her to send out an immediate flash announcing that a battalion of paratroopers is on the way from Luanda and is about to be dropped here, and have her repeat the flash several times. Then pass the word quietly that it is not true, otherwise the vigilantes may become overconfident. So there's real quick thinking by the doctor. Spread a lie to the enemy by way of the radio, and then tell the whites that, we are sending out a lie. This is not true. Don't get your hopes up. We're still in deep shit here. Pedro grabbed his rifle and jumped off the Land Rover, and the senior D'Souza, and the senior Dr. D'Souza. I keep saying D'Souza because there are many Portuguese that I knew, and the name D'Souza is quite common. And the senior Dr. D'Souza continued to the barracks, which were located 2 blocks from his house near the Ngage Road. He found the first sergeant, a robust man of about 40, with intelligent but tough features, at the entrance. "I was about to go and look for you, doctor," the first sergeant said as he leaned his elbow on the door of the car. "What on earth was the idea of sending the two platoons away where the damage has already been done and leaving this town naked?" the doctor asked, lighting a cigarette for himself and offering one to the soldier. "It was not the captain's idea, nor was it the lieutenant's or mine, doctor. What have you got here? Apart from the European corporal and 4 sipayos at the governor's," the first sergeant answered, "I have myself and 18 soldiers, 10 of them African." So he's got, there are nine Portuguese and 10 blacks. The doctor whistled with apprehension. "How reliable are your 10 African soldiers?" he asked. Let me pause there. You see, now you've got the problem of the mass of blacks are revolting. What about the blacks who are working for you? Are they going to turn on you as well? Are they going to join the enemy forces? So now you've got reliability problems. Can you trust your own blacks? And here is where all this stuff becomes important. And it's important. And this is where whites have less of this problem because whites are going to stick together. But multiracial diversity is our strength? Not really, hey? Not really. When push comes to shove, diversity is not a strength, and race starts coming into play. But there are black soldiers who are still reliable, and these guys will be reliable in this instance. "Quite reliable, I believe," the first sergeant said. "Not a single one of them is a Bakongo. 4 of them without uniforms I've sent out in the bush to scout the enemy." So the first sergeant has already sent out some blacks to go and start watching the other blacks. So it does help that they've got some blacks they can trust who can move around outside. That does help them. Some spies and traitors are always useful if they are working for you. But you don't want spies and traitors among your own people because they can do a lot of damage. "They should return within an hour, I hope. Can you spare any guns for my vigilantes?" "Not many, doctor. Maybe 4 rifles and a couple of revolvers." They appraised each other in silence for a few seconds. "Antonio, you are a professional soldier, and you've been around a long time. What do you honestly think our chances are?" the doctor asked, looking at the first sergeant in the eyes. Antonio wrinkled his forehead, scratched his chin thoughtfully, cleared his throat, spat, rubbed the heel of his boot on the saliva, and finally looked straight at the doctor. "Nil," he replied curtly. So you got a professional soldier, and he's telling you we've got no fucking chance at all. Our chance of living to the end of the day, our chance of seeing the sun rising tomorrow morning is zero. This topic comes up a lot in warfare, and it even comes up with the Germans, where there are many situations where soldiers fight and even the generals, even the commanders, don't really know if they even stand a chance. Many, many, many times. This is a reality, even among the best soldiers in warfare. So there are times when you just say, oh man, we're so fucked. And at least these people, they're just carrying on. These Portuguese are just facing it and they're just carrying on. They're not letting this destroy them. The doctor had to swallow twice before he recovered the power of speech. That is encouraging, he said finally. But you ought to know. Do you mind letting me in on your reasoning? The first sergeant cleared his throat again and switched the strap of his submachine gun from the right to the left soldier. I estimate the Bekongo mob over the hills, in the Kapim of the valley, and in the bush, Antonio began, his outstretched hand pointing successively to three cardinal points. I estimate them as close to 20,000, maybe more. Most of them are not worth much as fighters, but by the time they attack, they will be doped up, drunk with aguardiente, or their bodies will be rubbed with milongo by the witch doctors to make them believe they are immune to bullets. So no matter how many we may kill, they will keep coming until they overrun us by sheer numbers. So that is another point. In the early days of the fighting between the whites and the blacks, in the Congo and other places, they used the witch doctors and witchcraft as a way of making the blacks gain courage. Because the blacks also do not want to die. And this is something you must keep in mind always, is you don't want to die, but guess what? Your enemy also doesn't want to die. And no matter that he's a dumb black, he also doesn't want to die. So in those early days, they used drugs and other tricks to tell the blacks to either get the blacks into a state of mind so that they'll attack wildly, or they'll tell them that you are now bulletproof, that bullets, you know, can't harm you. And they get the blacks to believe it, and it allows them to do wild things. However, the reality is that although they tried those tricks, and those tricks do have some value, it's not something that was so successful that they used it again and again. And much later in the wars, they were more sophisticated and they didn't do these things anymore. Because it's useful for a moment, but it's not going to buy them that much. So what if the guy thinks he's bulletproof and somebody shoots him? You know, he's now dead. That's a reality. So there is some psychological games. There are psychological games going on in any kind of conflict. And make no mistake, everybody is scared in battle. The attacker as well as the defender. Unless the attacker is utterly confident in his abilities. And in many cases, they have to fake some confidence in order to do it. So Antonio had said, so no matter how many we kill, they will keep on coming until they overrun us by sheer numbers. So that is the big problem that whites face, and we still face it here in South Africa. And the whole issue is, can their numbers make a difference? And how much of a difference will their numbers make? So you will see what happens. And nobody will live to tell the tale, Dr. Souza remarked, lighting another cigarette with a hand which was no longer steady. You have it about right, doctor, the soldier said calmly, accepting another cigarette. But I hope I am wrong, and we have to go on from there. What about your soldiers, Antonio? That is what I wanted to see you about, doctor. I figure the thing this way, doctor. The UPA organization must have given a great deal of thought to this thing. And by the way, the soldier is right. They've been planning it for months. After all, Carmona is the capital of the district. If they take it, the rest of northern Angola will crumble. Carmona has probably the brightest street lights of any African town. These neon lights on the streets make the night as bright as day. I believe their first target will be the electric power station. I believe that I and my soldiers should barricade ourselves in the station and keep the lights going for you vigilantes as long as possible. I do not mean that this Bakongo mob fights well in the dark. They do not. What I mean, Doctor, is that the UPA fellows in Leo, who think that Carmona is a kind of fortress, must have realized that our defense in total darkness would be absolutely impossible. We would end up by shooting each other. Understand me, Doctor? So let me pause there. These people have no night fighting capability, and the battle is actually going to be fought at night. And the night is going to become critical, and the blacks are going to be using the darkness to help them, and the whites will need light, but they don't have night fighting capabilities. So if the power goes out, then they're going to be in big trouble. So this battle is weird, and it's fought at night. So the doctor says, I do, Antonio, and I agree that you should take up the power station. They shook hands solemnly, and the doctor continued on his way. As he turned a corner, he saw three truckloads of people, men, women, and children, parked in front of a tavern and restaurant. The tavern keeper, a typical colono with a barrel chest and hard features in shirt sleeves and carrying a rifle in the sling over his shoulder, was arguing irately with three men, all of them wearing coats and hats, obviously the leaders of three truckloads of people. This is actually going to be interesting. You'll see what comes out of this. We're going to have a bit of a Sidelander issue here. Watch this. Come here, doctor, the tavern keeper called out. These people are about to desert the ship. They heard that the road to Ngage is still open. Apparently a driver arrived from Ngage an hour ago and said that he saw no terrorists. I am telling them that they are cowardly. The doctor alighted from the Land Rover and joined the group. There are three roads out of Carmona, he said, slowly addressing the three men who tipped their hats as he approached. We know that the road south to Quitex and the road northwest to Songo and Nova Kaipemba are occupied by terrorists. As yet, we do not know whether they have cut off the road east to Ngage. But if they were not there when your driver came through, they may be there already. Listen to the drums. They are all around us. You are leading your families into a sure slaughter. You are being stupid, if not cowardly. Stay with your neighbors. That is the only thing you have left. Some of the women were weeping, but the children were playing with each other and seemed quite unconcerned. See, the children don't understand the seriousness of the situation. Let us stay, some of the women cried out from the truck. The three men were still hesitant. Impulsively, Dr. Souza drew his automatic from the holster and pointed the muzzle straight at the men. If you want to leave by God, you leave, he said sternly. But those women and children are staying. They would not have a chance on the road. Have we got any chance here, doctor? The most stubborn of the three men asked in return. Yes, we have, for as long as we fight, the doctor replied firmly. Deep in his heart, he could not bring himself to agree with the first sergeant's verdict. The doctor is absolutely right, the tavern keeper said. The three men shook their heads in doubt, but returned to their vehicles and ordered the drivers to turn around. I will be up there on the roof with my brother and cousin, the colono said to the doctor as he pointed to the terrace roof of his establishment. We all have rifles. Colono, I assume, is some kind of Portuguese term for colonizer, but it must have some more specific meaning. The doctor shook hands with the tavern keeper and wished him good luck. On his way down the main avenue, he turned on the radio. The announcer was now trustfully forecasting the imminent arrival of reinforcements. A whole regiment of paratroopers has now reached the skies of Uige, and those brave soldiers are about to be dropped off from the skies into the valley of Carmona to punish the terrorists. But in the meantime, it is important to keep our alert in town, for the terrorists may strike at any moment. So the radio operator, she's going to work. She's bullshitting for all she's worth, creatively. Dr. Souza turned off the radio. The vehicles of the vigilantes were now patrolling every street, driving along very slowly. The faces of the men and boys very tense and grim. As he looked at the upper windows and roofs of some of the houses, the doctor saw the muzzles of waiting rifles. The drumming in the hills and in the valley had not changed its monotone, but it sounded closer to the outskirts of town. The doctor stopped his Land Rover at the door of the Grand Hotel, and his son, who was talking to a group of vigilantes across the street, came over to join him. I think I will take my own car with four other men. The Mercedes is quite sturdy, and I can use it as a tank, Pedro said, as he readjusted the ammunition belt around his waist. So let me pause there. See, here he's thinking of using his car to like drive into the enemy crowd. These are the kinds of things you think of. Even I've sat and pondered about these things, you know. If you have a large crowd and you don't have a machine gun, you know, can you get a vehicle to dash in? Can you get a vehicle to dash in and smash into them and kill some of them? Good idea, Pedro, the senior doctor said. But let me just pause and say that there are issues with driving into people with vehicles. I am aware that people have gone with vehicles, smaller vehicles, and if you drive into a crowd, the vehicle itself can get stuck on the people, and then you can get killed inside the vehicle. So you need something that's sturdier and stronger. You know, maybe a truck is a good thing to use. But anyway, let's continue. Good idea, Pedro, the senior doctor said. They went in together and found a professional white hunter and his wife busy removing the grease from their hunting guns. So professional. So the hunters now, the hunters come in very, very handy now, hey? How important are the hunters now? Now hunting is critically important. Those who have hunting skills are now the most important of the civilian soldiers. Just think about that. Hunting and all the skills that you have from hunting animals now comes in handy in the shooting of people. Very useful skill. Hunting is excellent. We had all our guns greased and crated to take off for Luanda tomorrow on a vacation. And now this thing happens, the hunter remarked in disgust. Dr. Souza sat down and beckoned the waiter to bring coffee and cognac for everyone. He looked up at the wall clock in the dining room. It was 5 minutes past 3 o'clock. He set his own watch, his own wristwatch, by it. My wristwatch always stops when I get emotional about something, Dr. Souza complained. I am nervous myself. I am so relieved that our children are in Luanda, the woman said, without taking her eyes from the task of ungreasing the guns. So these people are afraid But they're continuing on. They're carrying on with their tasks. They're not freaking out. They're not running away. They're just carrying on. They're doing what they need to do. They're nervous, but they're carrying on. And that is important, very important. Jacinto, you know the Bakongo mind better than anyone, than anybody else, Pedro said, addressing the professional hunter. What do you think? About what? If you mean, who are they? The answer is, many of them are from the district, and perhaps just as many are Congolese from across the border. It is the same tribe, as you know. The UPA fellows from Leo must have organized this thing carefully, but I believe that only a minority of the mob will have firearms. Most of them will attack with katanas. By the way, my own gun bearer has joined them. He is a rat and always plays the winning side. He thinks we're done for. So, he says that he thinks only a minority of them will have firearms. So, that helps. That helps. But, notice also now how his own gun bearer has changed sides. So, the black who thinks the other side's going to win switches sides. Blacks, Jews, diversity is not your strength. These people will switch sides if they believe that you're losing. Jews are the oldest hands at this kind of thing. And the blacks themselves are very, very willing to flip-flop. Then they're your friend, then they're your enemy. But nobody is like the Jews. The Jews are the worst. But that'll give you an idea. So here you're in a desperate situation, and your gun bearer is just fucked off to go join the enemy. How cool is that? When will they attack? Pedro insisted. They're working themselves up to it slowly, as the Bakongo mind goes, the hunter answered. Then they go wild and blind, so to speak. I would say that they will not approach the town until sunset. There is no sun today, the doctor commented. Remember, it's a cloudy day. Some sketches from the book. I mean until darkness. Will you stay here at the Hotel Jacinto? Dr. Souza asked. I've organized a small group of sharpshooters, the hunter replied. We will take positions in the back windows of the hotel. The Capim is only 100 yards away. I don't know what the Capim is. It might be a road or a pathway, something like that. And they are sure to come through there. I have spoken to the first sergeant, the doctor said, and he is very pessimistic. How do you feel, Jacinto? How do I feel, doctor? Scared, naturally. Will they overrun us? Surely, if they keep on coming. There must be more than 30,000 of these clowns on the hills and in the valley. But the human wave may break and turn back if we kill enough of them and fast enough. So, the hunter is actually giving excellent advice. He's actually giving them excellent advice, good military advice. He's saying, the human wave may break if we kill enough of them. If we make it hard enough for them and they see their fellows dropping dead fast enough, they will lose heart. If they think that they can win, they'll hit you harder. But if you can make it really clear to them that they're losing, then they may quit quickly. Dr. Souza and his son shook hands with the white hunter and his wife and left the hotel. Outside, they separated to organize their respective patrols. Get something to eat, Pedro. The vigil may go on all night, the doctor told his son as they parted. Pedro nodded and waved au revoir to his father. Driving up the main avenue again, Dr. Souza could not resist the temptation of turning on the radio. It is impossible to answer all the telephone calls flooding the station, the disc jockey was saying. We do expect a terrorist attack late this afternoon or evening, but the attackers will be destroyed. So she's doing this woman is doing great propaganda. But the attackers will be destroyed. The troops and vigilantes have taken their positions and are constantly patrolling the edge of the town. There is practically a machine gun on every roof of Carmona and enough ammunition to hold back an army. The first battalion of paratroopers has landed in the valley and is now progressing toward the hills. More battalions are expected shortly. The Governor General is flying in from Luanda to direct the defense of Carmona. So the girl is really going to town. She's bullshitting all the way, hoping that it gets to the enemy. Nice going. Fuck with the enemy's head as well. Don't let the enemy control your mind. Fuck with their heads as well. Very good stuff. Fuck with them. Lie to them. Make them wonder whether they are going to live. Very excellent advice. The first sergeant with a native soldier at the wheel was coming down the street, and he stopped his jeep to palaver with the doctor. He also had a radio on. "Doctor, I'm afraid the radio announcer may have to go to purgatory for lying so much," the sergeant remarked. "Any news from your scouts, Antonio?" "Yes, doctor. Three of them have just returned. They estimate the Bakongo mob at 30,000 or more. Poorly armed, thank God. Many of them, my scouts say, are already drunk and doped, and that is bad because then they will not care. My fourth scout is missing. He was either caught or has joined the terrorists. Anything can happen." So you see, now some of the blacks are already flipping out. Either the black is killed or he's joined the terrorists. This is how these civil wars and race wars are going to go. And you're going to find that race is real. People are chopping and changing sides, depending on whether they think which side is going to win. This is quite natural. This will happen everywhere. So he says, "Goodbye, doctor. I'm going to round up my boys and take up positions at the power station." When the doctor returned to the gymnasium to enlist five vigilantes for his own patrol, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Some of the men were stuffing their ears with absorbent cotton to filter the call of the drums. "This drumming is driving me insane," one of the vigilantes said. Let me pause there. So the drumming must now be very loud. Must be very loud. So it may be psychological warfare to scare the whites. The blacks may be drumming to scare the whites, to make them think, "Oh man, you're gonna die, you're gonna die." But these whites are hanging in there. So the drums must be close and there must be a lot of them. "I find it relaxing," said another one. "It makes you feel that you're just watching the cinema." "I do not believe they will attack at all," said a third one. So everyone's got a different opinion. But that doesn't matter. Just carry on preparing. "When are the reinforcements coming, doctor?" asked the first one with cotton in his ears. "Are you joking, Kelowna?" said the second vigilante. One could not tell that the sun had set, for the low clouds were still hanging over the cupolas of the churches. But suddenly it was dark and humid, and the neon street lights were turned on. Thank God for white science, eh? White science and engineering. Carmona became a brightly lit stage of anxiety under a roof of darkness and surrounded by a chorus of promised death. The hundreds of drums were apparently descending from the hills and worming their way through the elephant grass of the valley. For the insanely monotonous beat was growing closer and closer to the hearts of the trapped colonos. Okay, so they're all, it's probably Portuguese for colonials. It was deafening. So they're using the drums as a psychological warfare mechanism against the whites to scare the whites. The noise is to scare them. And now the whites can hear the blacks are coming, and there's must be lots of them. It was deafening. Suddenly the hills to the north and northwest of the town became festive with hundreds of fires, some large, some small, which cast a macabre semicircle of orange and red shadows across the low clouds, as though in mockery of the white neon glow over the buildings and the besieged citizens. It was 8 o'clock in the evening. Then another sound of death was heard. Thousands of voices, eerie voices coming from the night and the trees and the tall grass, chanted in unison, incessantly, the maddening cry, Mata Upa, Mata Upa. This was the bloody warning of the terrorists. Kill UPA, kill UPA. And the chant went on. So the blacks are chanting, kill. And UPA is the organization. So now they're coming closer and they're using sound and everything to scare the whites even more. And obviously to make themselves feel more powerful. They themselves will gain courage from the chanting. The vigilantes on the roofs trained their guns, and the patrols in vehicles along the streets on the edges of town stopped their cars but kept the engines going, the beams of their headlights pointing through the night at the still invisible terrorists. At the power station, the first sergeant and his handful of soldiers waited tensely. Fingers on triggers, Antonio himself rested his left hand on a switch which would turn on the spotlights as soon as the attackers got within comfortable range of the machine gun, submachine guns and rifles. He had also placed boxes of dynamite in the control room with the purpose of blowing up a sizable number of attackers, the defenders and the building itself, should the terrorists break through into the station. So this guy is preparing to even kill himself and the enemy if they manage to break into the room. So he's going to do a suicide thing if it comes to that. But otherwise, the machine gun and the submachine guns are going to be used to keep the lights on in the town, because the lights are everything. If the blacks attack in the darkness, the whites are in trouble. In the center of town, in the gymnasium and warehouse, the women prayed, some weeping, some with dry eyes. The older children sat tensely by their mothers, but the very young ones played unconcernedly with each other. Some of the women with stouter hearts were on the roofs and at the windows with their men. The very tiny babies, the very tiny children, they don't know what danger is, so they're quite happy. Dr. Souza and his patrol were now waiting, with many other cars, at the south end of the road where the Quitex Road began. Any minute now, said one of Dr. Souza's vigilantes, as he lit a cigarette and rested his rifle temporarily on his lap. Mata Upa hummed unconsciously, a second vigilante, as though he could not resist the chorus from the trees below. Shut up and watch your aim, snapped a third man in the Land Rover. Any minute now, the doctor said, echoing the first vigilante. Suddenly he felt very calm. He knew well the temper of his tough colonos, and he knew that when the issue was as fundamental as this, each vigilante would dispatch a good handful of Bakongos before he met his maker. These guys in the streets fighting the blacks face to face, this is freaky for me. I'm astounded by this. But let's carry on. Abruptly, an uproar of screams and yells, punctuated methodically by the staccato of machine gun fire, came to their ears from the north end of town, and the church bells began to toll in the highest possible key, partially drowning the monotone of the drums and the chorus of the voices in the trees. They must be attacking the power station, said the first vigilante. Any minute now, said Dr. Souza, his keen eyes on the Quitex Road ahead. The first sergeant was right. The first wave emerged from the night, entered the orbit of the spotlights, which he turned on when the first lines were but 30 yards away, and tried to storm the station through its walls, and tried to storm the station as though its walls were made of cardboard. The deadly fire from the machine gun, the submachine guns and rifles of the 17 soldiers cut them down in droves as they advanced. Let me pause there. The white man's technology, even when there's vast numbers of people, numbers are not a problem when you have a machine gun. When you've got some kind of automatic fire, then numbers no longer mean much. But they kept on yelling and shouting their canhangulos and hunting rifles. Without hitting anyone. So they do have their rifles, and they continued to fall over the bodies of the men already fallen, until there was practically a wall of dead bodies around the station. So there are blacks who've got rifles, and they've got a thing called a canhangulo. I don't know if that is some kind of bow and arrow. But the military guys, the army, they are in a building that's safe. At length, they retreated into the elephant grass for regroupment. Let me just pause there. Elephant grass is extremely tall. So when you walk in elephant grass, it'll be way above your head. And so elephant grass, you can't see the people. It's very, very tall. The first sergeant turned off the switch of the spotlights and wiped his forehead with a red handkerchief. "Anybody hurt?" he asked. "Nobody," answered the native corporal, a Bailundo. Half of the soldiers take a smoke while the other half watches. Then the other half smokes, he ordered as he lit a cigarette for himself. Let me pause there. I think the smoking is also to calm their nerves. That's why everyone is smoking so much. But that's also normal from the times of smoking, when smoking was popular. When I was a kid, most of the adults smoked. So if people were nervous, they just smoked more. He looked at his wristwatch. The first attack, disorganized and clumsy as it was, lasted 20 minutes. There must have been well over 200 bodies lying across the narrow field. Okay, so in 20 minutes, they killed 200. That's their guess. So you're looking at about 10 being killed every minute. Machine gun works well, okay? "Sergeant," said a European corporal, meaning a white corporal, "my FBP will go bad after 300 shots. What should I use then?" Okay, so he's got a weapon that's not that good, and it's going to get worse. "I lied to Dr. Souza," said the sergeant. "I have 4 more subs in reserve in that crate. Take one when yours burns out." So the sergeant kept a few extras for himself, because he figured he'd need it. Difficult decisions. But, you know, you do what you do. Everyone just trying his bit. Dr. Souza's eyes were beginning to hurt from watching the narrow line of the Quitex Road, and his throat was drying up from chain smoking. "Any minute now," Dr. Souza said again. "I wish the bastards would come. This waiting drives me mad," said one of the vigilantes. "Perhaps they will not dare," another vigilante said, hopefully. "The lights are still on. Antonio and his soldiers must have beaten them at the power station." At that moment, the yells and screams and staccato sound of the guns came from the north end of the town. The vigilantes in Dr. Souza's Land Rover sat tensely, some watching the dark country road ahead, others watching the neon lights of Carmona. 5, 10, 15 minutes passed as the drums, the chorus of Mata Upa, Mata Upa, the church bells and the guns at the power station seemed to blend harmoniously into a pattern of musical madness. Then, as suddenly as it had started, the sound from the power station halted again. The lights of Carmona were still on. The vigilantes took a deep breath of relief. "Any minute now," said one of the vigilantes. "Can't you say something else?" snapped the doctor. The vigilante stared at him in perplexity. The uproar of battle suddenly reached their ears from another direction, the east end of town. They heard distinctly the shouts of the vigilantes, "Mata, Mata," which means kill, which in their anger they borrowed from the attackers as they charged upon them. "Oh wow, so the Portuguese are attacking the blacks and they are shouting, Mata, Mata." So they're not letting themselves be intimidated. Which in their anger they borrowed from the attackers as they charged upon them. Dr. Souza and his companions heard the blazing of the guns from the roofs and windows, the yells of fury and the screams of pain. And they saw smaller bands of terrorists emerging from the night, carrying bags full of rocks, which they threw at the streetlights. So again, let me pause here. Again, the blacks are prepared. The blacks have been thinking. The blacks have been thinking and planning, and now they're coming with bags of rocks, which they are throwing at the streetlights. They want the darkness. And so some thought and preparation there. A few of the lights were smashed, but the guns in the windows and on the roofs and from the speeding cars were mowing down the carriers of the hand artillery as quickly as they moved into the orbit of the light. So now the Portuguese know, man, stop them. Don't let them smash the lights. We can't do this in the darkness. There was a wide open area at the south end of the town where Dr. Souza and dozens of other vehicles of vigilantes were stationed. Suddenly, the elephant grass, 100 yards from their eyes, began to move. You see, the elephant grass is so tall that the blacks will be just a few meters from you and you won't be able to see them. "Here they are. May the Lord have mercy on my soul," murmured a vigilante next to Dr. Souza as he crossed himself. The human wave surged from the tall grass onto the open ground and up the Quitex Road, yelling Mata Upa, Mata Upa, and waving their weapons. Hunting rifles, homemade scatter guns. Interesting, homemade scatter gun. I wonder if that's some kind of homemade gun. Or canhangulos. A few pistols. So they've got a variety of weapons. They do have hunting rifles among them. And some canhangulos. And scatter guns may be a kind of a homemade weapon, a homemade gun. But the rest of them, and they've got some pistols as well. So they've got a couple of weapons, but the main thing is the sharp, deadly katanas, which resemble battle sabers. So the katana is almost like a machete, but not quite. It's more like a sword. So they have got a kind of a sword that can cut people up with. Okay, the wave in front was made up of the ones who were doped or drunk. The more sober ones marched behind the cannon fodder. So you see, being drugged isn't such an advantage to the guy who's drugged. He's cannon fodder. He's just protection for the others. "Drive into them," shouted Dr. Souza at the top of his lungs. As soon as the wave reached the open ground, with the engines roaring and the guns blazing, the vehicles of the defenders drove into the mass of attackers. But when finally the wheels were blocked by the piles of dead bodies, the vigilantes jumped out from the open trucks, jeeps and cars, yelling, "Mata, Mata," and they killed right and left with the uncontrollable ferocity of angry, trapped men. Many of them fell dead in the barbarous hand-to-hand combat, but the damage they caused to the surging wave was such that the attack became completely disorganized. less than 15 minutes after it started. So it says, so just going back over there, many of them fell dead in the barbarous hand-to-hand combat. But the damage they caused to the surging wave was such that the attack became completely disorganized less than 15 minutes after it had started. For a moment, the attack seemed to teeter idiotically. Then it crumbled like a deck of cards. The remnants of the wave retreated back to the elephant grass, still crying Mata Upa, but with less vigor, less conviction, and above all, with many voices lost. For they had left hundreds of dead or dying in the open ground. The vigilantes regrouped and backed the undamaged vehicles to their original position. I just want to go back to the part where they drive into the crowd. See, this is what I was saying. But still amazing, because here what they've done is they've used masses of vehicles as a means of killing blacks. And it looks like it's actually working pretty well. The only problem is the vehicles sometimes get trapped by the piles of dead bodies. But it says, just look at this, it says, with the engines roaring and the guns blazing, the vehicles of the defenders drove into the mass of the attackers. So they slammed straight into the surging black crowd with all these vehicles. But when finally the wheels were locked by the piles of dead bodies, the vigilantes jumped out from the open trucks, jeeps, and cars, yelling Mata. So that is actually not bad, because I'd wondered why they'd wanted open vehicles. And so open vehicles allows them to get out, because otherwise, if you're sitting inside a vehicle and you can't move, they can actually kill you inside the vehicle. So open, some pretty nifty thinking there. Very wild, eh? Very wild. I assure you, nothing like this ever happened again in Africa. Nothing. What these Portuguese are doing is unbelievable. And it says here, hundreds dead or dying. So Dr. Souza, who had been fighting and killing with an automatic in his right hand and a butcher knife in the left, returned to his Land Rover and wiped away the blood which had sprinkled on his hands and face. Then he looked around for his team. Three were back with him, two were gone. Okay, so this gives us an idea of casualties. His team was six, and two were already dead. So quite a few white men have already died in this first clash, in this first physical clash, the likes of which we've never seen in Africa since. Do you think they will try again, doctor? Asked one of the vigilantes. They will, the doctor answered. They could still hear the noise of battle from the ground behind the Grand Hotel and from the east of the town, but it had decreased in intensity. The chorus of Mata Upa coming from a distance behind the trees was still filling the air, and the church bells of Carmona were still tolling stridently, but the drums had died down, and the fires on the hills were withering. The lights of Carmona were still shining, despite many dark spots caused by broken bulbs. A jeep with four vigilantes in it sped down the avenue and came to a screeching stop by the doctor's Land Rover. We beat them twice at the east end, the driver of the jeep said, and there are so many dead piled up that it makes you sick. Dr. Pedro was killed. Are you all right here? So the bad news is that the doctor's son has died. So far, yes, one of the vigilantes in the Land Rover answered. The jeep sped away up the avenue. Dr. Souza pretended that he had not heard the message about his son. Presently, there was no longer any noise of battle from any part of town. The street lights were still on, and the church bells interrupted their tolling. The drums were silent. Only the chorus from the trees continued its chant. They waited. Around midnight, the last attack came. Once more from three directions, against the power station and from the east and south. But it was clumsy and disorganized. Only the odds were frightening. Again, the vigilantes attacked the attackers instead of waiting for their onslaught. And as the church bells resumed their desperate tolling, the last attack crumbled hopelessly, and the trapped colonos became then the chasers, going after the routed terrorists into the tall grass and the night, crying, "Mata, Mata," and killing with renewed ferocity until they became lost themselves or recovered their senses in time to return. So let me pause there. Now the whites are becoming crazy and wild, eh? The whites are getting into the swing of things, and they're even fucking chasing the blacks straight into the grass. They're not even afraid of meeting the blacks in the grass. They're sending them packing. The church bells halted their tolling. The town became almost silent. The only chorus from the trees was still sending its sinister message to the tired vigilantes. Then a torrential rain, quite unusual in March, began to pour over Carmona and the countryside, a torrent that poured incessantly until dawn, wiping the blood from the ground and from the grass, and transforming the roads and fields into pools of mud, and drowning completely the chorus from the trees. The weird battle of Carmona was over. When the rain stopped and the sun rose, the sleepless vigilantes collected the bodies of their fallen neighbors to give them proper burial in the cemetery. And they opened long and deep trenches on the Capim outside of town to bury the piles of dead bodies left by the attackers. No one bothered to count them. So that is the end of the Battle of Carmona, the weird Battle of Carmona. And something totally unique, unlike anything you've come across before. Okay, let's take a look at the violence after Carmona, and then we're going to look at some pictures, and then we're going to get round to looking at what defensive lessons can whites learn from these battles and these events. What comes home clearly to whites? And it's something that I'll be tackling in other videos, but this is the first part. And I'm going to show you through other videos that this is no accident. This is how warfare is. So, looking at what we know about the events in the invasion and the attempted genocide, the greatest number of deaths were on the 15th and 16th of March. So it's on the first 2 days of the surprise attack that the greatest number of deaths occurred. And thereafter, it started going down. It says that whites, mestizos, those are the mixed race, and blacks were slaughtered indiscriminately. 200 to 300 whites died on the first day. Now, that's interesting because the question is, how many died in Carmona? Mestizos, Assimilados, and Ovimbundu contract laborers were also targeted. So the blacks were totally racist, and they killed any non-black. And then it said, any who resisted the UPA were killed or mutilated, including their own tribe, the Bakongo, and the Umbundu villages. Some people, both white and black, stayed to defend their homes. But as you've seen in Carmona, only the whites were successful. So one of the questions that I have is, I don't have proper statistics for Carmona, and I can't find any. Maybe in Portuguese writings there are better statistics, but I have no clue at all. All that we can guess is that a few thousand were killed at Carmona in terms of the blacks. I've done some basic estimates based on just the storyline that's there. I think it's quite reasonable to expect that at least 3,000 blacks were killed at car owner. I think that's not an unrealistic expectation that at least 3,000 blacks were killed at car owner. How many whites were killed? Initially, I wondered whether 200 or 300 of the whites in Carmona died. But they say that on the first day, only 200 to 300 whites were killed. And that's across the entire region. And in some places like Quitex, they killed only about 40 or 50 or so. There were different numbers of whites killed in different places, and they went across large areas. So it almost looks to me like, I would say less than 100 whites died at Carmona. In fact, I think it's more likely that less than 50 died. And the only ones who would have died were those in those patrols. The numbers could be 30, could be 20, could be 10. I'd say, I would guess, my guess is 20 to 30. That's my guess. I can't do better than that. But I'd like to have gotten more accurate statistics on the blacks and especially on the white deaths. And the white deaths should be somewhere, but maybe it's sitting in Portuguese writings somewhere. In another article, which is a part of which I reproduced on the bottom there, it talks about this. It says, death of all Portuguese and any African Angolans who stood in his men's way. Then it says, close to 1,000 European farms were overrun, along with scores of trading settlements. So, almost 1,000 white farms were overrun. And that should show you that the farmers are in danger. In fact, there were other accounts that I've read where there are big estates and there are a number of whites on those big estates and blacks. And these guys come and they kill everybody. They kill like 20 people on an estate. And some of those people are whites. And even there are whites who try to shoot back, but it doesn't help them much. So, this is something to sit and ponder. Almost 1,000 farms. So, it should show you that the farms are not safe. Now, if we carry on and we look further on, by the 22nd of March, a week into the uprising, they were saying that several hundred whites had already died. So a week into the thing, the number of dead whites had gone up, but it was several hundred. And by then, 6,000 loyal blacks had been killed. Then if we look into the next month, I'm not sure by which date in April, but it says that by April, the UPA had killed 1,000 Europeans. And it got to within 50 kilometers of Luanda. Luanda's the capital. So we've seen that they've knocked out almost 1,000 farms. They've wiped out 100 administrative posts and towns. There were small places that did get wiped out. However, Holden Roberto had miscalculated. The blacks had miscalculated. They never expected the whites to fight back. Never. And if we read on, this is what it says. However, and contrary to the expectations of the UPA, the majority of the white inhabitants that were able to survive the initial attacks did not flee, except some women and children that were evacuated to Luanda. Instead, they entrenched themselves in several towns and villages of the region, including Carmona, Ngage, Sanza Pombo, Santa Cruz, Quimbele, Mucaba. Resisting the assaults almost without the support of the few existent military forces. Now, when I go and I look on the map, there are only two towns that I can see on the map, Carmona and Ngage. So San Zapombo, Santa Cruz, Quimbele, and Mucaba must be villages. That's my best guess. Yet, whites fought in six different places. Whites entrenched themselves in six different places, some of them we could call villages. And they were resisting the assaults without what few Portuguese army were there were hardly of any use in helping the civilians. There were too few to mean anything for the civilians, and these civilians entrenching themselves in those towns and villages were resisting the assaults even without military support, very little to zero military support. By the 1st of May 1961, now the other problem with the north of Angola is that the north of Angola is far away and the roads are few and bad. And you've got a problem in that you're dealing with an Angola-type situation. Lots and lots of vegetation on either side of the roads. This means that anybody can be ambushed. It's dangerous to go up those roads. Blacks can be lying in wait and they can corner you and kill you. Blacks could be a few feet away from you hiding in the bush and you won't even see it and they can start shooting at you. Ambushes on roads are a big thing that happened in Rhodesia and Angola. There's a lot of bush there. So this is a very dangerous situation. So for the Portuguese to actually get troops in large quantities into northern Angola actually starts taking time. Even though they've already flown them out of Portugal straight to Luanda, at the outset of these events, it takes them many weeks to actually get to these places. So these civilians are on their own. So if we read here, 1st of May 1961, the lack of landing strips prevented Portuguese troops flying in. The first Portuguese reinforcements began arriving on the 1st of May. It's already 6 weeks since the massacre started. 6 weeks. And you're going to see more. By May, Holden Roberto claimed he controlled 60,000 troops and had liberated an area that was 300 by 350 kilometers. This covered large parts of Luanda. He even had chunks of Luanda, the capital, Kuanza Norte, Uige, and Malanje districts. Now, the Uige district is where Carmona is. The Bembe Dimba, Buelo, Congo infiltration corridor and much of the area east of Makwela and the Angolan bank of the Cuango River. Notice this, by the 1st of May, the UPA fighters began wearing uniforms and carrying automatic weapons. 6 weeks into the fight and they're starting to get proper military equipment. The arms are believed to have been supplied by the Congolese troops, that is across the border, and by a UN contingent in the Congo. Can you believe? United Nations gave the blacks guns. That doesn't surprise me. So, United Nations gives guns to the murderers, eh? To the guys who are carrying out a genocide. So by the 1st of May, Holden Roberto's army is now 60,000 strong. But take a look at this. However, by the 1st of May, the city of Carmona, said to be 4,000 whites, with 10 urban complexes and 8 administrative posts, still resisted UPA attacks. So, Roberto's got 60,000 troops, and 6 weeks later, he has still not captured Carmona. Obviously, women and children are out of Carmona. There are still 4,000 whites there, and they have resisted attacks for 6 weeks with very few military on their side. But you'll see more. The UPA were threatening the harbour of Ambriz in the Luanda district and had besieged the town of Yukua in the south. UPA bands had penetrated to Katet and Maria Therese immediately east of Luanda. So he already had troops trying to fight their way into the capital, and they had some areas by the capital. By the 13th of May, a Portuguese force left for the area under attack, including two infantry battalions, an operational headquarters, and a large number of armed settlers. So other civilians are coming with them, and they're armed. The column avoided the direct but dangerous Coffee Road and took the longer but safer route via Dondo, Salazar, and Camabatela. Now check this out. It relieved Ngage with 1,000 whites and Damba and preempted attacks by large groups of UPA fighters. So here's another place. Ngage is slightly south of Carmona. And here we are 6 weeks after the massacres had started, and in Ngage are 1,000 whites holding out. 1,000 whites. I don't know how many whites are in Damba, but it should be obvious to you that 6 weeks with almost no military assistance, 4,000 whites have been holding Carmona and 1,000 whites have held Ngage. And there might be other places where whites are holding. Damba may be one of them, but we don't know how many whites there are. And I would assume that Damba's got less whites than Ngage. So, whether it's 500 or 300, I don't know. But here's a black guy with an army of 60,000, and he still hasn't knocked out the 1,000 whites in Ngage, still hasn't taken the city of Carmona. And his troops are starting to be better armed, and he's doing other things. So then, from the 13th of May to the 7th of October, it says Portuguese counteroffensive. The Portuguese had only 4 months of the winter dry season, because this is now in the winter and it's dry, and they succeeded in reoccupying northern Angola in the period of May to October. 20,000 reinforcements arrived in July to August. And by 7th October, they declared the military phase over. So it took them months for the Portuguese army to gain some sort of military foothold. But for 6 weeks, the whites were on their own, and whites were surviving in groups. Let's take a look at some film footage of the massacres just to give you an idea of how absolutely nasty it was. Let's just stop off the music there. So you can see some of the places in Angola looking quite nice. And here you can see a black. He's been disemboweled. Looks like they've cut his chest open. Look there. Big slashes on his chest. I'm not sure if these are white children or are these black children. Not quite sure. Here you can see lots of blacks. This is in Quimbela, 26th of May, I assume. Some places that they burned down. These could be white women, possibly raped. This one in the foreground looks like a woman, maybe raped. There's a woman, got her head cut off. Portuguese lady killed. They probably threw this stuff over her because she was probably raped. This is like a black that was killed. Looks a bit weird there by the genitalia. Maybe a white. Unfortunately, with this gray, it's hard to say how good these photos are. Some are overexposed. Probably a white, judging by the hair. A black. Black has been cut up as well. Not sure if they're beheaded as well. Somebody else also disemboweled. They also tortured people and so forth when they caught them. Blacks killed. Any blacks that resisted them or did not join them were killed. So this is how blacks treat their own traitors, and they are like this everywhere. Here you can see heads. These are the heads of blacks, so they've been cutting heads off blacks. Their goal is terror. All across Southern Africa, it was terror, 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 all the way down to South Africa, and including South Africa. Here you can see some blacks' head cut off. Possibly, I'm not sure if they're, I was going to say burned. This photo we've seen before. This is the same one as in the beginning, disemboweled. Blacks who'd had their heads cut off. That's actually not something that we saw elsewhere in Southern Africa, but these guys were trying terror at its finest. I suspect this is white. White person who's been killed, maybe a woman. That's where the heads are on that little area of ground there. There we see the heads again. So this is what they do to their traitors. Other blacks also killed. They killed at least 6,000 blacks and 1,000 whites, something like that. So it seems every black that they killed, they chopped their heads off. So they set out to use terror to the maximum. Yeah, definitely a white woman being raped. Maybe even worse than raped. Looks like they've been slicing up the genitalia. Looks like another woman. Multiple women. So nasty stuff, eh? Very nasty. Blacks. Also, some cutting there by the genitalia. Black guy. Head chopped off after all the other stuff. Obviously, the other stuff came first. You can see the various wounds. Another black hand cut off. I think some of these have been burned. When I look at their bodies, it's like they've been burned, possibly burned inside buildings. Also, possibly burned inside huts. So, some nasty stuff here. Cutting there by the arm, shoulder. Genitalia. Apparently, they cut a lot of genitalia off. And I think they even ate it. It's very possible. All part of their weird voodoo nonsense. You can see lots of blacks being killed in this place. Looks like a village or so. Killed, slashed up, burned. Looks like burned as well. We've seen this lady before. So some of these slides are repeating. But we're almost at the end. And I think that's pretty much it. So there you can get an idea of how nasty it was. So let's take a look at the lessons. What can we learn from this? Because there's been nothing like this, nothing on this scale before. And this is basically where the whites, for the first time in southern Africa, really put up a fight. And it's Portuguese civilians, completely caught off guard, no very little military support. And what did they learn? So the defensive lessons for whites are, number one, whites survive in defensive pockets. The only places where whites survive is when they gather together in a place and they defend that place. And that place is normally brick buildings. Brick buildings, we could regard it as impromptu fortifications. And I even read elsewhere that when they called people to come to the towns like Carmona, they were even calling the farmers. They're not saying to the farmers, you stay on your farm. They called them into the town. Everybody is safe when they gather together in a town and they defend the town or the village. So in this way, we're back to the fort. You will see in colonial times, even in America, everywhere where the Western nations went and colonized, you had forts. And the first thing you do is you set up a fort, and a fort works. And even buildings, even if you don't have a proper fort, using buildings as a fortification and fighting from those buildings works. And another lesson, big is better. In other words, the more people, the better. The more whites you can gather together in one place, the more they can defend themselves. It's the places where there are few whites. Remoteness does not save you. Gathering together in groups does save you. Gathering together in groups, in buildings, saves you. And you can go and look at any history, whether you go back to the time of the Romans and Greeks, and you'll see forts, forts, forts. Even in more modern times where you've got strong artillery, even in the Napoleonic Wars, even in World War II, even as recently as Croatia, you will find forts, fortifications make a difference. And a lesson for people about fighting back. Defense is simple and it's easy for inexperienced people. Those of us like myself who've never fought in a war before, fighting and defending a physical object, fighting inside a house, inside a building, shooting out from that, that works. That works. And if you are inexperienced, it's the simplest way to fight and to be effective. Defense works. And among the higher level military facts, if you go and you study actual what officers are taught and what officers believed, even in World War II, even afterwards, you will find that military officers across the Western world know this fact, that attack is harder than defense. In fact, according to the Allies, in order to win in an attack, you need three times as many troops as the defender. For an attack to succeed, an attack against other troops to succeed, you need three times as many troops attacking in order to win. So if you attack with twice as many troops as the defender, you're going to lose. Of course, these things are not hard and fast rules, but that'll give you an idea of the power of defense. That defense is very, very important. That attack is not easy. Even for the blacks, it's not easy. Now, people who advocate mobility and movement, attacking A is difficult, and moving in columns along roads is also dangerous. Attacking and moving is actually something that needs to be done very carefully. This is what professional and experienced people can do. Attack is dangerous, even is dangerous for the attacker himself. So convoys and mobility are things that you do need. Yes, you absolutely need them, but maybe not as your very first move. So your Saidlanders types who just want to run for convoys and head out onto the road, that's actually dangerous. What you should be doing is running for a position that you're going to occupy and defend close by, because you don't have much time to move. And rather defend a place nearby. Get into a defensive position, fight off whoever comes at you, and find your feet. First, get used to this before you think about other things. So, defensive pockets, you can have whites who are separated from each other, but they've gathered together in various defensive pockets. I'm going to refer to it as defensive pockets. Whether it's a building, several buildings, a village, or a town, that's your defensive pocket, depending on your numbers. And defensive pockets must first and foremost defend themselves. Then, when they have survived and they've able to defend themselves, then they can look at assisting each other. And you must remember in all kinds of conflicts that you cannot expect that everyone's going to be attacked equally. Some are going to be attacked, others are not even going to be attacked. They're going to be sitting there twiddling their thumbs, and maybe they can help somebody who's being attacked. Other things to consider with defensive pockets, especially if it continues for days and weeks, is that you can be supplied from the air. And I'm going to emphasize that if you study our history, especially the whites in Africa, if you study our history, and it'll even apply to the Americans, study your history, you'll find that we are at our best on the defense. Even a thing like the Battle of Blood River with those wagons were brought together as a form of defense, like a mobile fortification. So, defense is what I'm going to be talking about because, yes, you need to move, etc., etc., but rule number one is run to a place close by and defend yourself. And when you see more of the things that I'm going to show you, you'll understand why I have never been concerned about living in Johannesburg. Even though we're outnumbered here, etc., there are large numbers of whites here. And I did a whole bunch of investigation and studying of things, and I came to the conclusion that if they attack whites in large numbers, that they will run into big problems, even in places where you think the whites can be overrun. Here in a place like Johannesburg, we've probably got 1 million whites sitting here. Try and attack 1 million whites, even if they're unprepared. And for me, when I wrote my book, Government by Deception, and I had the chapter, The White's Last Stand, the big thing that I thought people would notice as the answer, I thought I'd put it right there in their faces, was that 5,000 whites could beat off 30,000 blacks. Going by the 3-to-1 rule, the blacks had more than a 3-to-1 advantage. In fact, the advantage of the blacks was even greater than just those numbers. If 30,000 blacks attacked the 5,000 blacks of Carmona, remember there were women and children there. Most of the women were not fighting, the children were not fighting. You could easily say that in Carmona that you only had about 2,500 whites actually fighting. So if you had 2,500 whites fighting and you had 30,000 blacks attacking, that means that the whites in Carmona were outnumbered, the fighting whites were outnumbered more than 10 to 1. They were outnumbered more than 10 to 1, and half of them did not even have firearms. And yet, they managed to survive. So they were outnumbered in actual combat more than 10 to 1, and they were mostly civilians. Apart from that guy with the first sergeant with the machine gun, other than that, everybody else was a civilian, and the best they had going for them were those who were hunters. And yet they survived. Yet they survived. They could not just be overrun. So the actual fighting whites were outnumbered more than 10 to 1. And they survived. And they survived for several weeks thereafter. Then we've got Ngage with 1,000 whites. And Damba, I don't know how many whites there are. I'm assuming that since they didn't give a number, that it's less than 1,000. Whether it's 500 or 400 or 300 or 200, I don't know. But Damba has also survived. So the main thing is when the blacks came and they flooded across this territory wanting to overrun the whites, kill them all. The places where they killed the whites, there was no farm. No farm that survived. All the farms were overrun, and anybody they ran into, they killed. The farmers and whoever was there was slaughtered. The only farmers who survived are the farmers that went into the towns. So even if you're a farmer, you need to get to a place where you can gather together with others. That is a very important thing. Buildings, buildings, buildings. Why do fortifications crop up in history over and over and over again, even in recent times? Why? Because it works. Even in the age of firearms, it works. Even in the age of artillery, strong artillery, it works. So I'm going to come back to looking at things like what happens in the rest of the year, because I want to look at the casualties, and I want to look at other consequences that you haven't thought of. And there are very interesting things that happen in the rest of the year. And I'll give you an example. The year starts out like this with what we could call Black Terror, and later on we get White Terror. What happens when the whites go wild? And even as you saw in Carmona, some of those guys on the ground later towards the end of the battle were chasing the blacks into the elephant grass. The whites are no longer scared. Once they're getting into the swing of things, and this is after only a couple of hours of struggle, and they're already starting to gain confidence. Wait until you see what happens later. So these whites are caught totally off guard, and you think they're going to be wiped out, and they're not wiped out. And here you can see quite clearly that in case after case, the whites who survived were the whites who got into defensive pockets. And that's important. And that is the key thing. And once we've done the video where we look at the rest of the year, which will be much shorter than this one, I want to take you to actual battles in other situations that are very comparable, and you will see the power of defense. In fact, I want us to go back to the Croatian War. There's something utterly shocking that I'm going to show you that happened in the Croatian War in the 1990s. It will blow your mind. If you thought Carmona is amazing, I'm going to show you something even more incredible than Carmona. And it's a similar thing. You won't believe some of the things that have happened. And so that is why I want to show you that even in combat, not just in Africa, even in heavy combat, seriously heavy combat, I'll show you other examples, and we'll look at different kinds of things, because I want to impress upon all whites that in any kind of racial and other conflict that starts, whether it's in South Africa or even whether it's in America or Europe, the first and foremost thing you must do is you must organize yourselves into defensive pockets and fight around buildings. That's the first and foremost thing you do. And you do it until all is quiet, until you survive. And then from there, then you can start looking at other more sophisticated things. Don't start out doing other weird things. Fleeing in convoys and rushing out into the open and thinking you're going to be safe just because you're far away. That's not possible, man. That's not possible. You can get killed far away. Even if they just send a helicopter with a machine gun to come and gun you down, you've got to get into a hardened position. And ways of surviving, you'll see the first thing is buildings and brick and concrete, and the other thing is trenches. Buildings, bricks, concrete, and trenches are proven methods of surviving. You can survive even heavy artillery, even bombing. And I can show you example after example of ways in which troops have saved themselves from tremendous attack. And you'll see those things again and again. And this is the way to begin. This is the starting point for any survival plan, is whites have got to get into defensive pockets. And as you see in Angola, they can stay in those defensive pockets for weeks. Well, later on, you'll find out that you can stay in defensive pockets for freaking months. You can stay in defensive pockets when you're totally cut off and troops are all around you. And in the case of Carmona, for example, in that map, you saw that blacks were coming from all different sides. Roads are dangerous, and you don't know where you can drive. And you've got to be really careful. But as long as you're in your defensive pocket, the blacks can be swarming all around you for weeks on end, and you're quite fine. So that is the main lesson for whites. If you're going to look at warfare, racial conflict, any kind of conflict, civil war, you name it, rule number one, defensive pockets. Don't get into other kinds of thoughts. I will return to what I wrote about the White's Last Stand and all that sort of stuff, because I wrote things in there about abandoning areas, etc. But I want to go back and show you many things. And I'll also tell you what frame of mind I was in at the time I wrote it. So this is very important. I want you to understand defense, defense, defense. And notice also how people with hunting skills, how useful they came in the fighting. Look at even that girl who helped her dad in Quetex, where the girl was shooting the blacks, and she's a girl, she's crying, etc. But her hunting skills are absolutely invaluable. So hunting, even simple hunting, I would think that hunting is better than target practice. If you can do some hunting, even small animals, even birds, even rats, any kind of hunting, get into that, start getting into that way of thinking. Because if you're trying to kill something, it's also trying to survive. And it brings with it other skills. Hunters, and you know what, even in Quetex, that guy, that butcher and his strange feelings that he had about the blacks, where he noticed the blacks are different. These things might have come from hunting. Hunting will teach you more than just shooting straight. It's going to teach you about being quiet. It's going to teach you about being careful. There are things you can do in small-scale hunting that is better than target practice. And you've got to get used to whatever weapons you've got. You mustn't be in a situation where if something happens, it was 2 years earlier that you last used your weapon. Got to get thinking in other ways. So that is the most important takeaway. And when I mentioned the Battle of Carmona in my book, Government by Deception, I stated that 5,000 whites beat off 30,000 blacks and killed thousands of them. And I thought that that was the most glaring fact in your face about survival. And yet it seems large numbers of people completely missed that thing. But back then, I didn't even have the detail that I have now. But now we've got much more detail, and we can see that this is not just a thing in Carmona. It happened everywhere. And I'm going to show you other wars where this stuff happens. And then you're going to be shocked at what you can defend. You're going to be astounded. Wait until I show you some stuff in Croatia. You're going to be shocked to death. You won't believe what you can do from defensive positions. If you keep your head and you hang in there. So, some food for thought. This is the path to survival, the true path to survival. And don't worry about being overrun and outnumbered. As you saw at Carmona, even one machine gun, man, the answer to everything is just shooting faster and having weapons that can shoot faster. If you've got a semi-automatic, if you've got an automatic, all those things are better. The machine gun invented in the late 1800s is the answer to being outnumbered and people overrunning you due to numbers. Being overrun due to numbers is not really an effective tactic. Not in this day and age. Even with weak firepower, it's not the answer. They can't just overrun you due to numbers. More than 10 to 1 in that battle, coming in vast quantities, how did it work for them? Didn't work for them. Thousands were killed. So, some food for thought for you about defense for whites. And defensive pockets, there's plenty I can show you about defensive pockets. Even the Germans took defensive pockets to levels that you cannot even imagine. Defensive pockets are the answer. Some of the most brilliant tactics I've come across came out of defensive pockets. So hold on to your area, survive, stick together, be able to face an attack from 360 degrees, hang in there at all costs, and later you can worry about other things. But that is the way to stay safe and to lose the minimum number of people. Defensive pockets. Not being on farms, not being distant, these things don't help. Small forces can go and overrun you, kill you in your home. You can see even in South Africa, farmers are being murdered. Farmers have a high murder rate. That should show you. Farmers are vulnerable. And in other wars and so forth in Rhodesia, I can show you more things about that. There are more lessons I can show you from Rhodesia that relate to farms, defending farms, night attacks, etc. So these are things for you to think about. Don't fear numbers. Don't fear numbers. There are ways around this. The enemy is not going to win just through numbers. Not at all. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.